will not let this fall into their hands, and you are the only one who can destroy it. Even as he says it, I sense the air around me pricking, charging. Air and I could tear this place apart easily, even if it would break my heart to do so. He looks at me with eyes so desperate, so pleading. Please, Violet, do not let them take this last piece of me. I have no choice but to agree. All right, I say, but only as a last resort. I reach out and place my hand on top of his. Azalea would be so proud of you. Lucian lets out a quiet sob, then pulls himself together. I truly hope so. He takes my hand in both of his and kisses my knuckles gently. I did not know how you would change me. I didn't realize my own prejudices, my own short-sightedness. I thought I knew everything. I thought I had a plan, and the execution would be simple. I was wrong. Haven't we all been wrong about this at some point? I say. I mean, isn't that how we learn to be right? You are a good person, Violet Lasting. I hope that never changes. You are a good person, Cobalt Rosling. Lucian starts at my use of his true name. I hope we both make it out of this. This city needs you. The mood has grown too somber. I try to break it. And I'm sick of being called Imogen. How do you handle it? Lucian crosses his legs and leans back. You know, I don't even mind it anymore. I've assumed ownership over the name, I suppose. There hasn't been a Lucian in over 100 years. Do you know, the Exeter named me himself, since there was no Electress when I was purchased by the Royal Palace. His eyes glaze over a bit with the memory. I was so scared I was shaking. There was an ancient woman named Gemma who trained me, and the Exeter came into the dining room while I was learning the finer points of service. He's an avid hunter, and I knew that. He asked me about all the different types of prey that are groomed for the Royal Forest, and the best methods to track each one. He asked me about the royal lineages. He gave me a gun in pieces and watched as I put it together, while a footman timed me. He gave me a list of taxes collected from some royal holdings in the farm and asked me to predict the percentage increase over the following 10 years. I had just turned 11. By the end, I was sweating. I remember the Exeter rolling up several sheets of parchment, handing them to Gemma and saying, "Most impressive. His name will be Lucian." And that was it. I wasn't Cobalt anymore. You still are, I insist. I suppose. He scratches his elbow. For all their preening and airs, the royalty are still just people. Twisted, yes, but people all the same. The Exeter was very lonely. I think that's why he married the Electress, because I have always suspected that he is still in love with the Duchess. Then why was their engagement broken? I wonder aloud. As far as that goes, Lucian says, standing, your guess is as good as mine. Come, we have lingered here long enough. As we leave the secret chamber, climb down the spiral stair, and emerge back into the bustling servant halls of the palace, I feel like I have just left a dream and entered the real world again. Lucian's workshop feels like a part of some other place, a piece of him made tangible. I truly hope I don't have to destroy it. 17. 1 week. That's all we have left. 7 days until the world changes, for better or for worse. Raven and Syl should be leaving for Southgate tomorrow, and the next train they take will be to the auction house. I'm carrying a basket of Coral's laundry down to be washed, lost in thoughts of the surrogates, of the auction, of the impending deadline that moves closer each day. Lucian's workshop keeps popping up in my head too. The bubbling beakers, the unfinished painting, the wall of clocks that symbolise his childhood. I hate the promise I made to him, but I know I'll keep it. Lucian is right. That place should never fall into royal hands. I'm barely paying attention to where I'm going, so when I round a corner and run straight into Dr. Blythe, I drop the laundry, and some of Coral's undergarments spill onto the stone floor. Oh! I cry, stooping quickly to pick them up. I'm terribly sorry. Dr. Blythe reaches down to lend a hand, but I wave him off. No, no, it's all right. I wasn't paying attention to where I was going. I take my time, stuffing a silk chemise into the basket. hoping he'll be on his way. You are just the person I was looking for. Dr. Blythe seems delighted to see me. The feeling is not mutual. Please remind Coral she needs to schedule an appointment with me before the auction, so that we may go over the protocol for creating an embryo. Compatibility with a surrogate, all that sort of thing.
Yes, I stammer, standing up.
Of course.
How would 6 o'clock this evening be?
I keep my eyes trained down at the basket in my hands.
That should be fine. She'll be in the bank for her final dress fitting at 2, but I can have her back by 6.
Excellent.
The doctor claps his hands together and gives me a polite nod. Good afternoon.
I drop into a quick curtsy and make my way down the hall, handing the laundry off to a red-faced washerwoman. I take the stairs back up the second floor by the east wing. Just as I've emerged from behind the bust of the old Duke, I run into another familiar face. Rye is impeccably dressed, as usual. I haven't really seen him in this palace without Carnelian, but he's alone now, and looking at me strangely. I curtsy again, for lack of a better idea. He glances behind him at the empty hall, then turns back to me.
Violet, he says quietly.
My eyes widen.
How?
But before I can say another word, he pulls me into a small room across the hall. Butterflies in glass cases line the walls. Rye grips my wrist, my pulse humming against his fingers.
Ash sends his regards to both of us.
Is he all right? I ask. Where is he? Have you spoken to him?
No, but someone else has. A mutual friend.
I assume he means another companion.
Who? When?
He chuckles lazily, and I wonder if he's on drugs.
No one you know, and yesterday.
Did he say anything about my brother?
Your what? No.
Rye looks me up and down and whistles.
He said he looked different, but wow, you surrogates are full of surprises.
I'm not a surrogate anymore, I say.
Right, he says. Anyway, I wanted to tell you earlier, but it's hard getting away from Carnelian.
I bet, I mutter. He grins.
Yeah, she's pretty obsessed with Ash. Can't stop asking me questions about him. The Duchess, too. At first, at least.
She stopped after a while.
Not Carnelian, though.
Terrific, I say dryly, switching the subject to more important matters. Has he spoken to any other companions? Are they willing to help us?
Help the Black Key, you mean? Sure. He shrugs. It's not like our lives can get any worse.
I bite my lip.
I'm staying in Ash's old rooms, he says. I'm sure you can remember the way there.
He winks.
Meet me tonight, and we'll talk.
I wait a few seconds after he leaves, then hurry down the hall to Coral's room. I'm so distracted by this new development while I'm dressing her for the trip to the bank. I end up putting her high heels on the wrong feet.
Is something wrong?
She asks. Nothing, miss. I'm sorry. I mumble, correcting the mistake. Miss Mayfield's is one of the top dressmakers in the Lone City. With a waiting list a mile long, and Coral cannot stop chattering about how fabulous her dress will be.
I chose pink, obviously, she says,
looking up as I apply her eyeliner.
My mother always wore blue or silver to the auction. She sniffs. Pink suits me better.
Yes, miss. I suddenly remember I haven't told her about the doctor's appointment. Dr. Blythe would like to see you this evening, after your fitting, he said.
My very first surrogate appointment.
Coral studies her reflection in the mirror as I finish with the eyeliner.
Of course. We'll be back well before then, won't we?
I've learned over the past few weeks that our whole schedule is entirely in Coral's hands. She doesn't want to do something. It doesn't happen. Yet she always insists on asking me anyway. Yes, miss, I say.
Will Garnet be accompanying us this afternoon?
I haven't seen much of Garnet since his father's death. He's thrown himself into his role as a regimental, making more trips to the lower circles than he had before. Coral giggles.
Boys don't come to dress fittings.
She scrunches her nose.
Carnelian will be coming, though. She's always so dull and serious.
Is Carnelian going to the auction?
Of course not, Imogen. She isn't married. But there'll be lots of festivities the day after. The dinners, of course, and some other parties. So she must look nice for those, even if she can't come to the event itself.
Coral fusses with a curl by her left ear.
My mother has been telling me stories about the auction since I was little, and I can't believe I finally get to go. It sounds so wonderful. There are rooms for entertainment and games on the lawns. It starts in the afternoon and lasts the whole day. And there are distractions for the women waiting to buy surrogates, and then things to do once you've bought yours. I've never been inside the amphitheatre before, but I've heard it's just lovely.
I have been inside that amphitheatre, and lovely is not a word I'd ever use to describe it.
There will be food and drinks and games to watch and musicians and jugglers and all sorts of fun things.
She looks so excited, as if the auction isn't about a bunch of girls being carted off to a strange place, drugged, dressed up, and then paraded onto a stage. As if all that fear, all that anxiety and worry, all that abuse is merely entertainment. But this auction isn't going to be like the others. I'm going to make sure of that.
18.
I sit in the motor car opposite Coral and Carnelian as we drive to the North train station. Miss Mayfield's is in the north quarter of the bank.
This is so stupid, Carnelian grumbles. After all those bombings and riots and stuff, I can't believe she's sending us out there.
Nonsense, Coral replies. There hasn't been a bombing in a week.
Not in the bank, maybe, Carnelian says. But the smoke and the farm are getting pretty dangerous, don't you read the papers?
I'm impressed Carnelian is following the society's movements, though I do remember, at a dinner so many months ago, the Duchess mocking her for working on her father's printing press. Maybe she's always read the papers, and I just never noticed. And privately, I agree with her. With the auction almost here, it's unsafe for royals to be in the lower circles. But of course, they don't know that.
The smoke has always been rather rough around the edges, though, hasn't it? Coral says. The bank is lovely. It'll be nice to have a change of scenery.
I still don't see why I couldn't have brought Rye, Carnelian says.
Yes, he's very funny, isn't he? Coral says. I remember when he was my companion. He used to do impressions of the servants that made me laugh for days.
I'd forgotten Rye worked for the House of the Downs. It seems wrong to me. Unnatural that Carnelian and Coral would share a companion. But I suppose it must happen all the time.
Don't remind me, Carnelian mumbles.
And he's a good deal nicer than that awful Ash Lockwood,
Coral continues, oblivious to Carnelian's murderous expression.
I remember how jealous I was when the Duchess procured him for you. My mother was dying to get her hands on him, but I suppose that worked out for the best.
Don't talk about him like you know him, Carnelian snaps, because you don't.
Well, neither did you, really,
Coral points out. Carnelian stares out the window and fumes for the rest of the drive. Our motor car pulls into a station that is even smaller than the one I arrived at when I was pretending to be Lily. There is no little house beside it. It's nestled in a copse of trees, their buds just beginning to blossom. The train is only one car, gleaming back with copper detail. The conductor jumps to attention when we arrive, doffing his hat and opening the train door for us. The interior of the car looks very similar to a royal parlour. There are two couches, one upholstered in silver with a pretty snowflake pattern, the other gold embossed with leaves, as well as two armchairs. Lamps decorate the various tables, their shades in muted tones of peach and beige. A miniature chandelier hangs from the ceiling. There is a marble statue of a woman in a long dress, a bird perched on her outstretched hand. A glass cabinet filled with liquor bottles sits beside a very large, very realistic portrait of the Exeter. Carnelian and Coral take seats on opposite couches. I've learned by now that my job is to stand quietly in the corner and pretend I don't exist. Today's paper sits on a small side table, and Carnelian picks it up and flips through it as the train rumbles forward.
I do read the papers, by the way, Coral says. There was an editorial by the Lady of the Dell about the inequity of pre-birth engagements.
Carnelian snorts. Please, that was a veiled attempt by the Electress to discredit the Duchess. Everyone knows she doesn't want the Duchess's daughter marrying her son. Probably why she sent those men to kill the surrogate at Garnet's party.
The Electress wouldn't do that, Coral says. It's treason. People are just jealous.
You don't really believe that, do you?
Coral very studiously ignores the question. Carnelian groans.
You act like you haven't lived in this circle your whole life. You know how ruthless it is.
That's such a cruel word.
Coral adjusts her hat.
People just have very strong feelings about things here, that's all.
Carnelian laughs at that, and I'm glad she can, since I can't. You're a joke, Coral.
At least I'm pretty and happy, she responds with a shrug. Maybe if you tried smiling more, someone in this circle will want to marry you.
I don't think it's my lack of smiles that's preventing any house from making a match with me, Carnelian says. Besides, there are more important things than finding a husband and buying a surrogate. It's Coral's turn to laugh.
Like what?
Carnelian brandishes the paper at her.
The city is falling apart out there.
At that moment, the iron door between the bank and the jewel groans open. The train moves forward slowly, chugging through the darkness until we finally emerge on the other side, reminding me unpleasantly again of just how big this wall is. But I won't be alone. It won't just be me trying to take it down, as Lucian once planned. I think of Indy and Sienna and even Olive, waiting in the marsh, ready to ride into the jewel with the girls being sold. I think about Raven and Syl hiding out near Southgate. I wonder how Ginger and Tawny and Henna are doing. I hope they'll be ready. That Amber and Scarlet and the other girls have helped them practice with the elements. I hope they learn from one another, strengthen one another. As light filters back into the train, Coral smiles smugly.
How is anyone ever going to get through that wall, Carnelian? We are perfectly safe in the jewel, and I'm sure this whole business will blow over soon enough. These ruffians will be caught and punished.
She sniffs, smoothing out her skirts.
Can't they be thankful that we provide them with jobs, put clothes on their backs and food in their bellies? It seems so ungrateful of them to be throwing these tantrums.
Once again, Carnelian speaks my mind for me. Coral, you have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. What you know about the lower circles could fit inside one of your stupid miniature teacups. The train slows and we pull up to the bank station before the fight can continue. It is as private as the one in the jewel, if not more. There are trees that hide it within the confines of a brick wall. A motor car waits for us just inside the golden gate that leads to the rest of the circle. I've only ever been to the south quarter of the bank for that brief time I spent with Lily and at the warehouse. Everything was pink stone and immaculate gardening. The north quarter is wilder. All the trees here are evergreens. The buildings are made from materials in silvery grey and pale blue, so they gleam among the dark green. Lots of them have white tiles for their roofs, giving the impression of newly fallen snow. We reach a street that is twice as wide as any other we've been on so far. It's filled with shops of every kind, and the chauffeur pulls over to let us out. We pass a store with boarded-up windows and scorch marks on its walls. A sign on the door reads, "Closed for renovations." A black key is scrawled over the words.
Ungrateful,
Coral mutters. Carnelian rolls her eyes, but she glances back at the building several times until it fades from view. She catches me watching her and quickly faces forward. I look away too. I don't need Carnelian studying me too closely. One or two other stores have broken windows and closed notices, and I catch sight of more spray-painted keys. The shops that remain untouched have large ornate signs, like the ones in the South Quarter. One proudly boasts the best milliner in the North Quarter over a display of brightly coloured hats. Another proclaims, "Fine linens make your house look like a royal palace." We finally stop outside a bright red building, a sharp contrast to all the iron and brass that makes up most of this quarter. There is an imposing branch of the Royal Bank to the left and a furniture store on the right. The sign over the red building's entrance says, "Miss Mayfield's Ladies' Emporium, purveyor of fine evening wear." A girl no older than me in a smartly cut black pencil skirt and blazer greets us at the door.
"Coral of the House of the Lake," she says warmly, "we've been expecting you, and Miss Carnelian as well. Come in, come in."
Coral soaks up the attention like a sponge. We walk into the store, and two other girls in similar garb are immediately called over. Coffee is poured, fresh fruit is offered, as well as a seat on a plush velvet sofa. Once again, I hover in the background, not needed except when Coral removes her hat and hands it to me. Dresses surround us, modelled on wooden mannequins or hanging on racks arranged by colour. The ceiling is so high that there are tiers of gowns accessible only by a sliding ladder on the wall, like the one in the Duchess's library. The floor is carpeted in a deep crimson, and the light fixture that hangs from the ceiling is wrought out of copper in the shape of many antlers, each point fixed with a glow globe, so that the room is bathed in a warm light.
"Miss Mayfield will be right with you," the head girl assures Coral. "You'll love it when you see it. It's absolutely stunning. She was up all night finishing it."
Coral looks pleased.
"What about my dress?"
Carnelian asks. She sits on a small puff with her cup of coffee, looking disgruntled.
"Oh, yours is lovely too," the assistant chirps.
"You must be thrilled,"
another assistant, who's nearly as tall as Indy, says.
"To have your aunt commission a dress like this just for you."
"Yes, I'm ecstatic," Carnelian replies dryly.
"We both are,"
Coral says, smiling enough for the two of them. "Have you seen the list for the auction yet?" the head girl asks.
"No, they never arrive until a few days before, do they? I can't wait to see what sort of saraquettes are on the docket this year."
"Not nearly as many as last time, though, are there?" the third assistant, a girl with bushy hair and a lot of freckles, asks.
"No," Coral says, "but it's really about quality, not quantity, isn't it?"
"Besides, no one's fighting for Larimer's hand in marriage anymore," Carnelian points out.
"We were so sorry to hear about that awful shooting," the head girl says. I notice she speaks only to Coral.
"Is it true they were after the surrogate?"
"Yes,"
Coral replies in a hushed voice.
"Everyone is saying it was the Electress," the freckled girl interjects, as if hoping to get confirmation of this from Coral.
But the head girl silences her with a sharp look.
"No one knows who is behind it," she says curtly. "The Duchess must be so worried for her surrogate's safety."
My stomach lurches, Hazel's frantic pleas ringing in my ears.
"She keeps her secure in the palace,"
Coral says.
"And no more parties until the little bundle of joy is born," Carnelian says.
The tall girl titters nervously, as if she's unsure whether or not Carnelian is making a joke, and if so, whether she is supposed to think it's funny.
"Is she showing yet?" the head assistant asks. "Yes, she's got 'em quite big."
Coral puts down her china cup.
"So remarkable that the Duchess managed to orchestrate the engagement before the sweet little girl is even born,"
the tall girl says, moving closer to be part of the gossip.
"However did she manage it?"
"You know the Duchess,"
Coral says airily.
"If she wants something, she will do whatever it takes to get it. She wanted me for her son, and look how that turned out."
All the assistants laugh.
"Now, girls, give the ladies some air."
The woman who enters from the back of the shop is style personified. She wears a floor-length plum-coloured gown that hugs her curves perfectly, accentuating her hips and breasts. The detail is astounding. Beads are sewn into the bodice and skirt in a wave pattern, taking up one whole side of the dress, like an ocean of blue and silver and lilac. A simple shawl is draped around her shoulders, giving the effect that she just threw this outfit on without really thinking about it. Her hair is a vibrant red, at sharp contrast with her midnight black skin. Like the Duchess, this is a woman with the power to silence a room. The three attendants hush and back away.
"Coral, how delightful to see you again,"
Miss Mayfield says, swooping down to kiss both of Coral's cheeks.
"And Carnelian, you're looking lovely."
Her gaze lands on me.
"Ah, did you get a lady-in-waiting at last?"
"She's mine,"
Coral interjects before Carnelian can respond.
"Garnet bought her for me."
Miss Mayfield gives her a feline smile.
"Your husband is a good man, though I do wish he could help with our little key problem here in the bank. I've had to repaint the walls of my shop twice already."
"Vandals," the head assistant agrees. "He's doing his very best,"
Coral says, and I can't hide my smirk at that. Fortunately, no one except Carnelian sees me, her face turning curious. I quickly smooth out my expression. Miss Mayfield nods.
"Well, let's not drag ourselves down with depressing matters. We have gowns to see."
She claps her hands, and her assistants scatter like well-trained mice. The tall one opens up a set of wooden doors, and the bushy-haired one wheels out a mannequin in a blue dress, the head assistant following behind her with a pink one.
"It's beautiful,"
Coral gasps, reaching out to touch the soft fabric. I thought mine was going to be red and black, Carnelian says, looking disdainfully at the blue chiffon as it's wheeled in front of her.
Yes, darling, but unfortunately the Duchess pays the bill, and she felt your chosen colour scheme was a bit too intense.
Miss Mayfield pats Carnelian's shoulder.
Don't worry, she says in a low voice. It's going to fit you like a glove.
That was the exact phrase Lucian used when he allowed me to choose my own dress for the auction. For a moment, I'm back there in the prep room, staring at my face for the first time in 4 years. A bell tinkles as the front door opens. A bankwoman and her daughter enter. The little girl can't be older than 5 or 6, with thick black plaits in her hair and a cute little hat with a yellow ribbon.
I'm so terribly sorry, Mrs. Linton, Miss Mayfield says, but we are closed for the afternoon.
Mrs. Linton looks miffed before she sees Coral and Carnelian.
Your ladyship,
she says, making a little curtsy and nudging her daughter to do the same.
I did not. I am so sorry. Of course, Miss Mayfield, we will come back tomorrow.
She wheels out of the shop, dragging her daughter with her. I guess Carnelian counts as a ladyship in the bank, even if she doesn't in the jewel. Miss Mayfield turns a sharp eye on the head assistant, who in turn glares at the freckled girl, who runs over to lock the door and hang a clothes sign in the window, pulling a shade down over it.
Now, Miss Mayfield says, where were we?
Quickly, the three assistants strip the royal girls of their gowns, leaving them in only their slips. Miss Mayfield helps Coral into the stunning pink number, a gown with a sweetheart neckline and a subtle skirt bolstered by a layer of tulle. The only ornamentation is around the waist, tiny flowers made of diamonds and rubies.
What do you think, Imogen?
She asks, twirling for me. It's perfect, miss, I say. And it is. She really does look lovely. All three assistants scatter once more and return, each carrying a full-length mirror. They move this way and that in perfect unison, almost like a dance, so that Coral can see every inch of herself.
I love it,
she says, and Miss Mayfield looks pleased. Carnelian is next. As she steps into the blue gown, Miss Mayfield herself fastens the dress up.
Oh, Coral gasps. Carnelian, you look beautiful.
She sounds jealous, and I don't blame her. The gown Miss Mayfield has fashioned for Carnelian is unlike any ball gown I've ever seen. The skirt is made of chiffon, pretty layers that float to the ground like clouds, but the bodice is carefully cut out in satin ribbons that form a crisscross pattern, navy blue silk layered over baby blue lace, so that her ivory skin peeks through. It cuts off in a tight circle at the base of her neck and right at her shoulders, leaving her arms bare. It makes Carnelian look like a woman in her own right, someone who could turn heads at a ball.
What do you think? Miss Mayfield asks.
It's perfect,
she whispers. Then she whirls and embraces the dressmaker. The assistants look away, embarrassed.
Well, let's make sure everything is as it should be.
Miss Mayfield snaps her fingers, and the mirrors disappear. She takes out a pair of strange eyeglasses and a measuring tape, and begins to examine every seam and hem.
Loose thread here, she mutters, peering at Carnelian's left shoulder.
The tall girl makes a note,
and let's take...
But whatever she was going to say next gets lost, as the wall opposite me suddenly explodes in a deafening burst of heat and plaster and dust. 19. I'm flying through the air, thrown backward into a rack of dresses. Some deep protective instinct causes me to join with air, so that the rubble and debris shooting toward me are deflected in a gust of wind. The dresses soften the blow as my back slams into the wall, my connection with air broken. Sparks explode in front of my eyes, my ears ringing. For several seconds, or maybe minutes, I lie there, half hidden by layers of satin and wool and brocade. My chest heaves as I struggle to breathe. My head feels like it's been stuffed with cotton. Everything is dull, muted. Slowly my hearing returns. The first thing I notice is the screaming. One long, sustained scream. I sit up, rubbing my left ear, and see the head attendant standing in the midst of the ruined shop, staring at her arm. Something sharp and white is poking out of her skin. thick lines of red dripping down her forearm into her hand. I swallow back the bile that rises in my throat as I realise it's her bone. Her arm is shattered. Miss Mayfield's dress is torn down one whole side, and there is a large bruise blossoming under one eye. She's crouched on the floor, tending to the tall girl, pressing a green lace ball gown against a gash on her forehead. I don't know where the freckled girl is. Diamantes are littered all around us, glittering in the rubble like stars. My brain is slow to respond, my head fuzzy. Where did all this money come from? Where are Coral and Carnelian? The picture forms in front of me like a jigsaw puzzle with some pieces missing. There's a giant hole in the wall opposite me. Through it, I can see broken tiles and melted hunks of copper, splintered wood and huge chunks of concrete. A man's shoe, a broken lamp, and fire. Fire everywhere. The bank, the Royal Bank next door. Those are the targets the society is hitting. I scramble to my feet as the girl with the broken arm shrieks louder. The fire burning through the bank has caught on the carpet of the shop. I can feel its delicious heat from across the room, but it's headed straight for Miss Mayfield and her charge, devouring every scrap of silk and lace in its path. In the distance, I hear the faint wail of sirens. They'll never make it here in time. I join with fire. An excruciating burst of heat accompanies the element. My skin boils, a pain that is unbearable and welcoming at the same time. Fire always makes me feel equal parts alive and frightened. For a second, the flames flare higher, but I am in control now, and I calm it, slowly and steadily, focusing on my heart beating in my chest, focusing the fire to recede. It shrinks down to half its size, then a quarter. Then it is nothing more than a few wisps of smoke wafting up from the remains of a charred carpet. A crack of its heat echoes over my skin as I release my hold on the element. I come back to myself and immediately search for the two royal girls. When I see the high heel hanging from a limp foot, my heart turns from fire to lead. Coral is pinned beneath a large hunk of plaster. Blood seeps out in a dark puddle from underneath her. "Coral!" I cry. I try and lift the plaster, but it's too heavy, the sirens in the distance getting louder. "Coral, no! No!" I shake her shoulders. Her head bobs around, lifeless. Her eyes are closed, almost as if I've just tucked her into bed, except it's concrete instead of blanket on top of her, and she'll never open her eyes again. I sit back on my heels, pressing my palms against my own eyes as if I can rub this horrible sight from my brain. I hear a small moan from behind an overturned sofa. Forcing myself to move, I stand and leave the corpse of Garnet's wife behind, to find Carnelian trapped beneath the sofa, alive.
"I can't breathe,"
she croaks. "Just hold on," I say. "I'm going to get this off of you." I connect with air again. The initial swooping sensation in my stomach that accompanies the element doesn't give me the same thrill it usually does. Instantly, the air around me is ready, waiting. As I push my fingers underneath the edge of the sofa, I can feel its entire weight, not just the smooth mahogany frame that I'm touching. I am aware of all of it. I am the air underneath it, and around it, and nestled in its cushions. I am everywhere. "Lift," I think. As I stand, air pulls with me, and the sofa is thrown into a mannequin with such force that its head comes off its body. Carnelian rolls onto her back, gasping for breath. "Are you all right? Can you move? Are you hurt?" My hands flutter around her uselessly, afraid to touch her.
"My ribs."
She clutches her side. "Stay still. Help is coming." The sirens wail again. I grab the remains of an indigo gown, balling it up and gently lifting Carnelian's head to rest it on the makeshift pillow. "You're going to be okay," I say again, more for myself than for her. Her breathing is shallow, and there's a deep cut on her shoulder. I press another gown to it to stanch the bleeding.
Is she?
Carnelian stares past me to where I know Coral's body lies. "Yes," I whisper, and the guilt is agony. A hot knife twisting in my gut, a punch in the chest that leaves me breathless. All those bombings. I knew it was violent, of course. But this... Carnelian begins to cry, tears rolling down her cheeks. "Shh," I say, taking her hand in mine. "It's okay. We're okay." I don't want to die,
she whimpers. She looks so frightened, so young. I might not like Carnelian, but in this moment, we are the same. We're just two scared girls. You're not going to die, I say. Help is coming. You're going to be fine. I squeeze her hand. I'm right here. I won't leave you. She looks at me with an unfocused gaze.
I know your voice,
she says. Her brows knit together for a moment before her eyes widen.
You,
she gasps. I nod. I don't even consider lying. Carnelian's lips part. She lets out a little huff, then her eyes roll back in her head, and she sinks into unconsciousness. Minutes later, regimentals run into the ruined shop. One immediately heads for the screaming girl, while two more move to help Miss Mayfield and her charge.
Help the royals! Help the royals!
Miss Mayfield cries, pointing to where I sit by Carnelian. A young regimental rushes over. Are you hurt, miss? He says. No, I say, but she is. Her ribs, I think, and her shoulder.
Medic!
He calls, and a man in a grey coat with a black bag comes over to look at Carnelian. The head girl is taken away, cradling her broken arm. Four regimentals manage to get the hunk of plaster off Coral. The entire lower half of her body has been crushed. I close my eyes and hate myself for my cowardice. I should watch this. I deserve to see what the Society of the Black Key is doing. I gather my courage and open them again. Coral is being put in a black bag, like the one they put Raven in when they sent her to the morgue. Two regimentals carry her out of the store. Carnelian has been put on a stretcher.
She's from the House of the Lake, isn't she?
The young regimental asks. I nod.
She'll be all right, the medic says. I'd guess a couple of broken ribs and that laceration on her shoulder will need stitches. Best get her back to the jewel. She'll be safest there.
He glances at the sofa smashed against the wall.
Was she underneath that?
I nod again.
And you lifted it off her?
I stare at him blankly. Of course I did. He looks impressed, but I don't feel very impressive right now. I feel hollow.
Come, miss, the regimental says, putting a gentle hand on my shoulder. Let's get you out of here.
He leads me to an ambulance waiting outside. Carnelian is slid in after me, along with the medic and another regimental. Right away, he starts asking me questions. Did I see anyone suspicious near the bank when we arrived? Did anything seem off? Do I think Miss Mayfield could have something to do with it, or one of her assistants? I answer no to everything as the ambulance tears through the streets. Where's Coral? I ask.
She's well taken care of, don't you worry.
The regimental pats my knee. The conductor is shocked when we pull up at the station.
Get this train ready to leave now, the medic yells at him. And let the jewel know, Carnelian of the House of the Lake has been injured in a Black Key bombing. Where is Miss Coral?
The conductor asks. But the regimentals blow past him with Carnelian, and he pales at the sight of her unconscious form. He jumps into the driver's seat, and I rush into the carriage behind everyone. The train lurches forward as I stumble into the statue of the woman with the bird. The regimentals have moved aside one of the couches so that Carnelian's stretcher lies out on the floor. I can't believe she and Coral were in this train car, snapping at each other only an hour ago. It doesn't seem real. When we arrive in the jewel, there is a glamorous motor car waiting, with an extra-large back seat. A chauffeur opens the back of it, and the regimentals slide Carnelian inside.
Just the one?
The chauffeur asks. The medic nods and repeats what he told me about Carnelian's condition. I ride in the front with the driver as he peels through the streets of the jewel. Gravel flies from under the tyres as he pulls up to the Palace of the Lake. The doctor is waiting by the garage with one and six.
This way,
he says as they rush to get Carnelian out of the car. He pulls down on the branch of a shrub that I thought was real, but instead slides aside to reveal a dark tunnel and a set of stone stairs. The secret passage to the medical room I couldn't find. They vanish down into the darkness, and the shrub glides into its original place. The chauffeur goes to park the car in the garage, and I find myself alone. I don't know where to go, what to do. Everything feels like a dream. My feet take me wherever they want, and I end up in the kitchen. The servants are huddled together in groups, talking worriedly. Even Rye is there. The silence that falls as I enter is abrupt, like someone pulling the needle from a gramophone.
Maud is the first to spring into action.
Imogen!
She rushes over. Are you all right? Are you hurt? What happened? She's in shock, Rai says. And then Zara is by my side, a big bowl of broth in one hand and the end of a baguette in the other.
Sit down, she says gently,
and I realise there's a stool beside me. I wonder if it's been there the whole time and I only just noticed it.
Clara, bring a wet washcloth, Zara commands.
Mary and Elizabeth gaze at me with fearful eyes, as if I'm something unreal and dangerous. I clutch the baguette like a lifeline. It's still warm, and the scent reminds me of my mother. Hot tears fill my eyes.
You're all right, child,
Zara says, wiping my face with the cloth.
Be still now. You're safe.
I didn't realise how badly I was shaking.
Back up, back up, Maud says. Give the poor girl some room to breathe.
All the room in the world won't make breathing any easier. I look down at my dress, and for the first time have some idea of what I must look like. The white fabric has turned a mottled brownish grey, covered with dust and bits of rubble. There is a large tear in one sleeve and blood on the other. My hands are crusted with dirt and more blood. Coral's blood on my hands. When I'm finally calm enough to breathe normally, Zara begins spoon-feeding me a bit of the broth. I'm surprised at how quickly it helps steady me and clear my muddled head.
Now, she says, taking my hands in hers, tell us what happened. All we know is that there was an explosion in the bank.
I nod.
And Coral and Carnelian were injured.
I close my eyes.
Dead? Rai gasps.
Just Coral, I croak. There are more gasps and murmurs.
Was it the Black Key?
Yes, I say. There was a royal bank next door. I don't think they intended to hurt. I don't think.
I don't know what I think. The fact is, the society did intend to hurt people. I just never thought about it being people I knew personally.
Poor Garnet, Maud says. First his father, now his wife.
I hadn't even thought about Garnet. I wonder how he'll feel. Probably the same way I do. He might not have been in love with Coral, but he didn't hate her.
Suddenly, a bell begins to ring in the kitchen. A tiny golden bell that I've never seen ring before. All the servants stare at it, dumbstruck. Then Cora appears in the doorway.
The Duchess wishes to see everyone in the ballroom immediately.
Her gaze lingers on me for a moment. Then she turns and we all traipse after her. Mary and Elizabeth whispering together. Maud's face wary, William looking more ruffled than I've ever seen him. We file into the ballroom, where the Duchess stands waiting for us, resplendent in black satin, with long gloves that come up over her elbows.
As you may have heard, she says without preamble, there has been another vicious attack on our house. This time, from the society that calls itself the Black Key. They have killed our beloved daughter-in-law, Coral, and severely injured our niece. This will not stand. The regimentals are doing everything in their power to stop these rebels. But we will not let them dampen our spirits. We will stay strong and unified in the face of our aggressors. I have sent an emergency petition to speak with the Exeter. I am hopeful he will be able to make time to see me tomorrow. I want everything spotless. I want smiles on faces and pep in your steps. I want to see you proud to serve this house that helped found our great city. Do I make myself clear?
Everyone nods in unison.
You.
The Duchess points a finger directly at me.
Come with me. The rest of you are dismissed.
20. I'm surprisingly calm as I follow the Duchess out of the ballroom. Maybe there's simply nothing left in me to feel. After the day's events, I wonder if I'll ever be able to muster up any strong emotion again. I should be terrified right now. I should be worried the Duchess could discover me, could recognise my voice, could kill me. But as she opens the door to a small study, a grim determination sets in. Hazel is still in danger. So are Ash and Ochre. Raven, Syl, Sienna, Indy, Olive, all the girls in the holding facilities are counting on me, on this plan,
on the fact that this year, at this auction, they will not be sold as slaves. They will declare themselves free citizens of the Lone City. I hate that Coral died, but she is not the first person who's died because of this cause, and she certainly won't be the last. The Duchess sits in a leather armchair and studies me over steepled fingers. You have done an adequate job as Coral's lady-in-waiting, she says. I curtsy. And I like that you don't prattle on like so many other maids in this house. You'll stay here as Carnelian's lady-in-waiting. She should like that. She's been asking for one long enough. She smirks. And that way you can't run off and sell your story to the papers or another house. I'll have your tongue ripped out if you try. I hadn't considered that I'd be dismissed from service. Coral hasn't even been dead 2 hours. Yes, my lady, I say huskily. Thank you, my lady. The Duchess sighs and rubs her temple. She glances at the clock on the mantel, and I realise I've been in this room before. The first time I ever wandered around the palace alone, the day I met Ash, there was a picture of the Duchess on a roll-top desk, a small, lifelike painting. In a moment of rebellion, I used the first augury, colour, to change her skin from smooth caramel to garish green. She nearly broke my hand because of that. You're dismissed, the Duchess says sharply. I curtsy again and rush out the door, heading in the direction of the servants' quarters. Cora is waiting for me outside the dining room. The halls are empty. Did she make you Carnelian's lady-in-waiting? She asks. Yes. Good. She was going to dismiss you. I tried very hard to convince her otherwise, without tipping my hand, of course. Cora fingers the key on her belt. I hope you have a plan for auction day. I don't miss the note of warning in her voice. I do, I say. It's not entirely a lie. The doctor is still seeing to Carnelian at the moment. You will attend to her in her room this evening. Yes, ma'am. She looks me up and down. You could use a bath and a change of clothes. I look down at my ruined dress. Yes. You may use my private powder room if you wish. Oh, and Violet? She leans in close to me, so I can see the wrinkles around her eyes. If you do not keep up your end of our agreement, then I promise you, your sister will be in very real danger, and not from the Electress. A chill runs down my spine. She turns to leave and calls back over her shoulder. The Exeter will be here tomorrow morning at 11. Be ready and in the foyer at 10:45 sharp. I look in on Garnet that night, after I bathe, before attending to Carnelian. I find him taking Coral's miniature tea sets out of their glass display case, wrapping them in brown paper, and putting them in a box. Hey, I say. Are you okay? He looks down at the saucer in his hand, a looping pattern of silver and gold etched around its edge. I wasn't really sure what to do with all these, but she loved them so much. I didn't want Mother to get her hands on them. She'd probably have a good old time smashing them against a wall or something.
That's really nice, I say. Coral would appreciate it, I'm sure.
Garnet wraps the saucer up and places it in the box. You all right? You weren't hurt, were you?
No,
I say, remembering the way my instincts took over, joining with air to protect me from the worst of the debris. I'm fine.
She didn't, I mean...
He clears his throat.
Did she suffer?
No, I say quietly. It was instant.
He nods.
I'm so sorry, Garnet, I say. First your father, and now...
I'll be all right.
He sounds dazed.
Everything is getting real, isn't it? It's not just a vague plan back at the White Rose anymore.
It isn't, I agree.
Ash must be losing his mind.
I frown. Why do you say that?
Garnet's eyebrows shoot up.
Violet, he knows you are... Sorry, you were. Coral's lady-in-waiting. You can bet the entire bank knows about the bombing and her death. He understands how the jewel works. He'd know you'd have been with her at that fitting.
Oh, no, I gasp, my hand flying to my mouth.
Lucian will find a way to tell him, Garnet says.
Or Rye, I add.
Rye?
He knows.
I fill Garnet in on what happened earlier.
That's really great, he says. He could be helpful at the auction house.
I know he means it, but the sentiment comes out half-hearted. I understand the feeling. I'm so exhausted. All I want to do is curl up under the covers of my bed and not come out for a day. But I have to face Carnelian and then meet Rye tonight in Ash's old chambers. I give Garnet's arm a squeeze, and he smiles wanly. I leave him with the tea sets and head to Carnelian's room. I've never been inside it before. Maud only showed it to me in passing on my first day as a lady-in-waiting. I knock.
"Come in,"
Carnelian says from within. Carnelian does not have chambers like I did when I was a surrogate. Her one room is large and airy, with a view of the garden. It contains a four-poster bed, a round mahogany table with two chairs, a dressing table, and a chaise lounge by the window. One wall is lined with bookshelves. Another has a pretty painting of a farmhouse that reminds me of the White Rose. She lies in bed, the bandage on her shoulder poking out from beneath her nightdress. Her arms rest at her sides. But her face is alert. From the way she's looking at me, it's clear she hasn't forgotten the moment she recognised me earlier, before she slipped into unconsciousness.
"So," she says as I close the door behind me, "you came back."
I swallow. "I came back." My heart thumps in my chest. Now that I'm face to face with her, with the threat of dying removed, I don't know what she'll do. She could call for the regimentals at any time.
"Why?" she demands. "Ash is safe."
Her eyes widen.
"He is safe, isn't he? I read in the papers he was sighted in the bank, but I didn't think it could be true."
"He is safe," I say. Then I add, "and it is true."
"How could you let him do that?" Carnelian snaps. "He could get caught. She still wants to find him, to kill him."
"I didn't have a choice," I say. "He left without telling me."
"Because he doesn't trust you?"
she asks hopefully. "Because I wasn't there," I say. Because I left him to come here." Carnelian chews on her lip.
"Why? Is it revenge? Against the Duchess?"
My jaw clenches and she smiles smugly.
"Good. I hope you get her before the Black Key burn this city to the ground."
She cocks her head.
"It's something more, though, isn't it? Not just revenge."
She pauses, studying me. Then she gasps.
"Of course. The surrogate. Whoever the Duchess stole to replace you. You're here for her, aren't you? Is she a friend of yours?"
"Something like that," I say. Then I blurt out the question that's burning in my throat. "If you knew the surrogate wasn't me, why didn't you tell anyone?"
"Oh, don't think I didn't try," Carnelian says. "It was the perfect trump card to hold over her. But the Duchess plays dirty. She threatened to have me committed to an asylum if I so much as breathed a word."
Her mouth sets in a hard line.
"I hope that whatever you're planning, you make her suffer the way she deserves."
"Aren't you frightened?" I say. "You were nearly killed today." Carnelian's laugh is hollow.
"Even if I had died, no one would care. The Duchess would probably throw a parade."
She stares out the window. The sour mask she usually wears falls away, replaced with an expression of utter hopelessness.
"It doesn't matter to anyone whether I live or die."
I remember what Ash said to me when we were waiting in the morgue for Lucian to come. He told me Carnelian was sad, and that sadness had been twisted into bitterness and anger. All the time I lived here, I saw her only as a nuisance. I saw the sulliness and ignored the grief and pain beneath it. Because she's right. No one in this palace would care if she had died today. All the hatred and resentment I've held on to against Carnelian melts away. I see a girl who's been put down and mistreated for so long. I see the girl Ash saw, the one I ignored because I was busy being jealous and petty. A girl who misses her mother. A girl who wants to be loved. I make the decision then to be brave, where once I was timid, to be a different person, a better person. I move toward her and sit on the bed. She rolls her eyes.
"What? Are we going to be best friends now?"
"No," I say, "but we are on the same side."
"What side is that?"
"We both hate the royalty, right?" She narrows her eyes at me and waits. "And we both love the same boy," I say. I hold out my hands, palms up, as a peace offering. You want to turn me in, do it. Ring the bell. Call the regimentals. My life is in your hands. You can end it right now. Carnelian hesitates. I can see the desire to cry out, to have me handcuffed and executed for treason. I know the danger I've put myself in, but I look into her brown eyes and sense the war going on inside. Who does she hate more, me or the Duchess? The seconds stretch into minutes. I won't break the silence.
Your name is Violet, right?
She says finally. Yes.
Well, I guess I should thank you for saving my life.
Ash never would have forgiven me if I didn't try. The yearning in Carnelian's face is a palpable thing.
Does he ever talk about me?
I take a breath and give her the honest answer. Right before I left, he told me to be careful around you, that you are sharper than I gave you credit for. A tiny smile lights on her face.
He said that?
I nod. She leans her head against the pillow and stares up at the ceiling. Can I get you anything? I ask.
No. I want to be alone.
I stop at the door and turn. He cares about you, you know. I hate it, but he does. He's been defending you ever since we escaped, since before then, really. I know it's not what you want, but... I sigh. He cares. Carnelian does not look at me. She very deliberately closes her eyes.
Go away,
she whispers. And just as I close the door, I see a tear tumble down her cheek. Every bone in my body aches. My eyelids are dry and my mind is numb. It has been a long day, but still, I have to see Rye. I take a servant's staircase down to the first floor and pause when I reach the hall where the library is. Joining with air, I push it out from me in a gust, then pull it back. I smell boot polish and hear the even steps of a regimental. I slip back into the secret passage behind a sliding panel of wall and wait. The footsteps draw closer. Then they pass. I count to 30, then sneak out into the hall and run as quickly and quietly as I can to the library. As soon as I enter the tunnel, my arcana starts buzzing. I pull it out of my hair and talk as I walk. Are you all right? Lucian is distraught. Were you hurt in any way? No, I say dully. Coral's dead. I know. I'm so sorry you had to experience that. Why? The word comes out sharp and pointed. This is what a revolution looks like, isn't it? It's about time I saw it, acknowledged it. You got me into this. Don't apologize now. I can feel it in the silence emanating from the tuning fork. I know I've hurt him. I stop walking and press my forehead against the cool stone wall. Sorry, I mumble. I didn't mean to. To what? Be honest. Never apologize for that, Violet. You're right. This is what a revolution looks like. What are we going to do with them, Lucian? I ask. The royalty. Are we just going to kill them all? There are many in the society who wish for that. Blood for blood. What do you think? I think there has been enough death already. I think we should set them to work. See how the others in this city have lived for so long. Make them tear down the Great Wall with their own bare hands. He sighs. How I would love to see that, and see the ocean beyond. This city has been isolated for ages. It would be nice to know what is out there. The ocean. I'd like to see that too. I'm going to see Rye now, I say. Ash got a message to him. He knows about me. That is excellent news. And he will be at the auction? Tell Garnet. I'm sure he can find a use for Rye and the other companions who will be at the auction house. I already told him, I say. Oh, and I've been reassigned as Carnelian's lady-in-waiting. She knows about me too. She recognized my voice. I hear a sharp intake of breath on his end. She won't tell. I gave her the chance, even told her to go ahead and do it. But she hates the royalty more than she hates me. Well, hasn't this day just been full of surprises? It's all really happening, isn't it? Yes, honey, it is. I have to go, I say. I want this night to be over. I want to sleep, to lose myself in blissful oblivion. Of course. I hold my hand out for the arcana to drop, but it stays hovering in the air. Violet, Lucian says, and his voice is timid.
Yes?
I am so very proud of you. The arcana falls into my hand, and I clench my fist around it, squeezing it tight before setting off down the cold, quiet hall. 21. It is so strange being back in this parlour. I open the secret door behind the oil painting of the man in the green hunting jacket with the dog at his side, and find Rye standing by the window, waiting for me. The room is dark, the only light coming from the moon outside.
I didn't know if you'd come, he says as I shut the painting behind me, after what happened today.
I told you I would, I say, and there isn't much time left anyway.
No, he agrees, there isn't.
We stand in awkward silence for a moment. I'm almost afraid to ask about Ash, even though he's why I'm here. Rye moves to sit on the sofa. I take the armchair by the window.
Ash managed to contact one of our friends, who wasn't working at the time. A guy named Track found him on the row. You've seen the row, right?
I nod, remembering the sleazy strip in the bank filled with cheap taverns and brothels.
Track's been in pretty bad shape for a while. He drinks too much and cuts himself. He was probably going to get marked soon.
Ash explained to me about marking. If a companion fails to be perfect in every way, they are tattooed with a black X on their right cheek and kicked out of the companion house with only the clothes on their back. All their earnings revert back to their madam.
So, Rye continues, Ash told him all about you and the society and the rebellion and how things could change, how they already were changing. He offered Track the chance at a new life, painted a picture of what was possible. He gave him...
hope? I say softly, my throat swelling up. He gave Track hope. Why was it so hard for me to see it back then, at the White Rose, when I brushed aside his desire to help the companions because it was too dangerous?
Yeah, and it caught on like wildfire. There are tons of companions who hate their lives, and I'm sure he's told you, and I include myself in that category.
Rye tugs at his curls.
I was killing myself with blue. Now, at least if I die, it might actually mean something. I won't just be another anonymous companion overdose.
I'm glad to hear he's not using any more.
Then Track got assigned to the House of Light, and I saw him at one of the thousand parties I've gone to with Carnelian. Rye smiles, his teeth a flash of white in the darkness. Ash told him to look out for me. He told him I should contact Coral's Lady in Waiting. I didn't get it at first, until I overheard you talking to Zara. It wasn't even the sound of your voice, so much as the way you spoke.
He throws his arm over the back of the sofa.
I guess you made an impression on me at Madame Curio's.
I'm flattered.
We've been making contact with other companions in the jewel too. Ash is famous now.
I know, I say, smiling myself this time. So it all goes down at the auction, right? Yes, you should talk to Garnet. He'll be able to give you some advice about what to do.
Garnet? Rye says incredulously. Garnet of the House of the Lake, Garnet.
I nod. He whistles.
This thing is deeper than I realised.
I'm surprised Ash didn't tell you.
I'm not. He didn't talk to me directly, remember?
Right. I gaze out of the window. The moonlight sparkles off the surface of the lake in front of the palace. This room was where he told me what he did, what being a companion was really all about. This is where we fell in love. It's such a personal sentiment, and I immediately regret saying it out loud. Sorry, I say, blushing. You don't need to hear that. There's a pause. I look at Rye and see his posture has changed. He leans forward, staring down at his hands. Yeah, he says quietly. I do. I'm not sure what to say.
We are the unloved, he continues after a moment. And unlovable. That's what they train us to think. We are objects of sexual and monetary value. Who could love someone as filthy as a companion? We are made to look pretty, but we are rotten on the inside.
I don't think you understand just how important you are to him.
I don't think you understand the value of your love. Because let me tell you,
he looks me right in the eyes.
It is priceless.
I'm about to say I know, when I realise I don't. Being a surrogate never made me feel unlovable. It made me feel cheap and used and angry. But I had Raven and Lily. I had my mother and Hazel and Ochre. Ash had Cinder, and then nothing. And even Cinder wasn't enough to stop him from hating himself. I remember his words the night we fought before I came back to the jewel. And what do I have, Violet? You. just you. I thought it was an exaggeration at the time. I never thought Ash would find it difficult not just to love, but to be loved as well.
And now he's passed that hope to us, Rye continues, that we might actually be able to live a life of our choosing with someone who wishes to be with us, not someone who pays for the pleasure of our bodies. Companions are smart. We are well-trained and extremely disciplined. Give us a purpose, a single-minded focus, a cause that unifies us. Well, another flash of teeth in the night. We're a force to be reckoned with.
Yes, I say, you are.
What's your role in this whole thing?
I'm going to bring down the wall that separates the bank and the jewel. I'm going to let the people into this circle once and for all.
The words come out easily, with a confidence I haven't heard in my voice before.
Rye's mouth falls open.
By yourself?
No, I say. I'll have some help.
Who?
I hold up a hand. I'll explain another time. I can't muster the energy to tell him about the surrogates and the paladin tonight.
Of course, it's late. You must be exhausted.
Rye stands as I do, ever the gentleman. I walk over and wrap my arms around him. He hesitates at first, then returns the hug.
You deserve to be loved, I say.
You all do.
He doesn't say anything, just squeezes me once, and I release him. By the time I make it back to my chambers, I barely have the energy to slip my dress off over my head before I collapse onto the bed and fall into a dreamless sleep. When I wake the next morning, there's a crick in my shoulder from sleeping on it wrong. I groan and roll onto my back, sunlight streaming through my open windows. I gasp and sit up. The clock on the wall says it's 9:45.
Crap!
I yelp, throwing on my spare lady-in-waiting gown and shoving my hair into a bun. The Exeter is coming today. I need to have Carnelian dressed and ready in an hour. I skip the kitchen, figuring I can bring her something after she's dressed, and dive through the tapestry of the Duchess by the dining room. I pound my way up the stairs, slowing my pace when I enter into the main halls and knock three times on her door.
You're late,
she calls, and I take that as permission to come in. She sits up in bed, a tray of half-eaten waffles beside her.
Mary brought me breakfast. My bell doesn't connect with your room.
She smirks.
Mary hates you, by the way.
I bristle. She hates you, too. Carnelian flushes, then shrugs.
Everybody hates me.
I don't have time to feel bad or even argue with her right now. Come on, I say. Get up. You can boss me around all you like today. That's got to count for something. A broad smile spreads across her face. I have to help her out of bed because her chest is taped up. The doctor gave her pain medication, so her ribs and shoulder don't hurt. But the tape makes manoeuvring her into a dress take longer than usual. Somehow, we manage to make it to the foyer by 10:42. Rye meets us at the top of the main staircase, all in black. He doesn't even glance at me, smiling at Carnelian and offering his arm.
How are you feeling?
He asks as they descend the stairs. Carnelian leans on him heavily.
I'm all right, she says. Whatever the doctor gave me is working. I don't want to go to any parties tonight, though.
As far as I know, our schedule is completely clear. We can do whatever you wish. We reach the foot of the stairs, and I slink into line beside Cora. Rye and Carnelian stand with Garnet and the Duchess, who are already waiting at the front doors. The fountain twinkles merrily, surrounded by black-clad servants and maids. Even Zara is in attendance, looking strange out of her apron. The red coats of the regimentals and the white dresses that Cora and I wear are the only splashes of colour. The minutes tick past. At 11 o'clock on the dot, an opulent motor car pulls up. Little flags whip in the wind from their perches above the headlights. The royal crest is emblazoned on them, as well as on the motor car's doors. The Exeter emerges from the car and climbs the steps to the palace, trailed by two members of his private guard. The entire foyer bows and curtsies as he enters.
Pearl, he says in a commanding voice, I am deeply sorry for your loss. As you said in your letter, it is truly a tragic time for the House of the Lake.
Thank you, Your Grace, the Duchess replies. I am honoured you took the time to visit me here.
The Exeter smiles,
It's a surprisingly nice smile. His beard is close-cropped and streaked with hints of grey, but you can see the strong jaw underneath.
"You wish to meet with me?"
he says. "Yes," the Duchess replies. "If you will accompany me to my private study, we can speak there. Cora can bring us refreshments."
"That won't be necessary," the Exeter says, stopping Cora in her tracks.
"As you wish," the Duchess curtsies again. I've never seen her be so deferential.
"Please, follow me."
They begin to ascend the staircase. The Exeter's guards shadow him, but he waves them off with a hand.
"You will wait for me here."
They reach the second floor and disappear. It's like everyone in the foyer was holding a collective breath. The regimentals break ranks, one and two moving to stand by the main stairs, four and five going over to greet the Exeter's guards. Zara claps her hands, and all the scullery maids follow her down to the kitchen. Garnet turns to Ryan Carnelian.
"I'm off to the library. We'll have to be back here soon enough when he leaves."
"I'll come with you," Carnelian says. "I need to get a new book."
She glances at me with a smug smile.
"Come along, Imogen."
I bob my head and try to look docile.
"Are you sad?"
Carnelian asks Garnet as we walk through the halls.
"About Coral?"
"Of course."
"But you didn't love her."
"That doesn't mean I wanted her to die."
We pass the dining room and make a right.
"I'm glad you're all right," Garnet adds.
"Thanks."
This whole quartet is so strange. I know about everyone. Garnet knows about Rye, but not Carnelian, and vice versa. Carnelian knows about me, but not Garnet and Rye. Is this how Lucian feels all the time?
"What do you think they're talking about?"
Carnelian asks.
Garnet shrugs. "Not a clue. Mother is probably angling to use Coral's death."
He stumbles over the word.
"To some advantage or another."
When we reach the library, Garnet spreads out onto one of the leather couches and throws an arm over his eyes. Carnelian peruses one of the shelves with Rye.
"Imogen, it's hot in here and I forgot my fan," she complains. "Go get it for me from my room."
I can tell she's enjoying her position of power. "Yes, miss," I say with a strained curtsy. I turn to leave, passing the table with all the crests on it, and then a family portrait of Garnet with his father and mother, when an idea occurs to me. The Duchess said she was going to her private study. When I was first looking for Hazel, I discovered a hidden staircase that led me to a study with a photograph of the Duchess's family in it. It was a place that felt intensely personal. What if she and the Exeter are there now? I pretend I'm leaving the library, then make a sharp left and dart behind the shelves. Silent as a ghost, I make my way to Cadmium Blake's Essays on Cross-Pollination and slip down the tunnel. I find the staircase and climb it quickly. Murmured voices tell me my suspicions were right. I reach the door to the study and am shocked into stillness by a sudden burst of laughter.
"Oh, Onyx,"
the Duchess says. There's a silence, and then the unmistakable sound of kissing. The Duchess is kissing the Exeter. I knew they were engaged once, but...
"I'm tired of this charade," she says.
"I know," the Exeter replies. "So am I."
"Did you bring it?" There is a rustling, and then the sound of something clattering onto a tabletop.
"From her personal library," he says.
"And no one saw?"
"Not a soul. Not even Lucian. I think he believes she is behind the shooting. At least, he doesn't suspect you or me."
That is excellent news. I'm trying to make sense of what she's saying. The Duchess and the Exeter were the ones who planned the attack on Hazel. But why? "It really is a beautiful piece," the Duchess says with a sigh.
"I gave it to her for the longest night 2 years ago, very publicly."
There is a pause. I don't think she appreciated it. "She is too pedestrian to understand it." The Exeter laughs.
"She doesn't have your love of history or your passion for fine weaponry."
Weaponry? My heart sinks lower in my chest. What is happening here?
"It was your great-grandfather's, wasn't it?" the Duchess asks.
"What an excellent memory you have.
I can hear the smile in the Exeter's voice. I remember everything about us, she says. I've never heard her sound so vulnerable. Every single second. I first saw this when I was 13 and we broke into that old chest your father kept in one of his studies.
We got into quite a bit of trouble for that.
The Duchess's laugh is gentle and full of memory. We did, didn't we? My father kept me locked in my room for a week.
And I arrived 2 days into that week and demanded he release you.
Yes, I'm sure you were very intimidating.
I'm surprised he didn't box my ears.
So am I. It's the Exeter's turn to laugh.
I'm certainly wanted to, but I don't think my father would have been so forgiving of one of his subjects accosting his own son.
What do you think our fathers would make of us now? The Duchess asks. There is a long pause.
I don't think I care, to be honest. After what they did. After. It was our lives, Pearl. Our lives.
And they... I know, she says softly. I hear a stopper being popped off and liquid poured into glasses. I'm worried, Onyx. What if we fail? What if people don't believe it was her? We need the royalty to love this engagement. We need them to be so attached to the joining of our houses that there is an outrage when the surrogate is murdered. She's trying to kill me. Hazel's words come back to me with full force. Someone in this palace is trying to kill her. I was just wrong about who.
Yes, I've thought on this quite a bit, the Exeter says. Your house has garnered so much sympathy recently. What if we were to make use of all that goodwill?
In what way?
We make the auction double serve as an engagement party for Larimer. A grand affair, not like Garnet's little promotion celebration. We will make it the event of the century, and we will open the invitation to every member of the royalty.
Of course, the Duchess says. The royals will love it, especially the unmarried ones who wouldn't be able to come otherwise. A party on top of a party.
We appear as a united front. No one will doubt the validity of this engagement. Then, when the surrogate is murdered with the Electress's dagger, this circle will turn on her like a pack of wild wolves.
Oh, my darling, the Duchess says. She murmurs something too low for me to hear.
I could have been better, the Exeter says, his voice straining with emotion. I should have been, with you by my side.
We can't change the past.
I should never have let...
Shh. There are more muffled movements. Soon. After the Electress is hanged for treason, this will all die down in a year or so.
That seems so far away.
We've been waiting 28 years, the Duchess says. I think we can wait one or two more. I don't understand. If they love each other so much, why did the engagement break off in the first place? There is a silence, and then he asks her something in a whisper, too soft for me to make out. I don't know, she replies, and she sounds like she's in pain. I never knew. It was too early to tell. Too early to tell what? I want to shout.
I am so sorry, he says.
I know, my love, she murmurs. I know you are. One last bit of kissing, and then the Exeter says,
I should be getting back. The announcement needs to be made.
Yes, of course, she chuckles. It's going to send this circle into a tizzy. There's the sound of footsteps, and then a door closes. I slide down the wall and perch on the edge of a stair, my heart thrumming in my chest. The whole thing has been one elaborate scheme to get the Exeter and the Duchess back together, at the cost of my sister's life.
22. The announcement that the auction will serve as an engagement party as well throws the circle into gleeful chaos, as the Duchess and the Exeter predicted. Invites come pouring in, for cocktail parties and luncheons and wine tastings. Everyone wants the Duchess's attention. The loss of Coral and the Duke, mixed with the ironclad promise of a union between the Royal Palace and the House of the Lake, makes the Duchess the jewel's most wanted woman. And with only 1 day left until the auction, the palace is buzzing with excitement. I haven't spoken to Lucien since the Exeter's visit,
but tonight is the annual pre-auction dinner party for the founding houses at the Royal Palace. Unfortunately, Carnelian was invited, which means I'll get to see him one last time before the city changes, for better or for worse. This development also means Carnelian will be attending the auction, a huge relief, since Coral's death meant I would not have had a reason to attend myself. The lower circles have been bubbling with discontent. Fires, lootings, more bombings. The farm is in turmoil now, too. The factory workers in the smoke have been striking. I haven't spoken to Rye privately again, but I manage to get a moment alone with Garnet before I prepare Carnelian for the big dinner. He tells me Rye reached out to him. He's very excited to have the companions on board.
They're really good with strategy, he says, adjusting his bow tie, and they already know how to fight. When you paladins start causing all that chaos, we're going to be ready. It's like the royalty trained the perfect weapons for us.
I quickly fill Garnet in about the conversation I overheard between his mother and the Exeter. He whistles.
Well, I can't say I'm entirely surprised. She's been in love with him for years. You didn't hear what broke off the engagement, did you?
No, but that's not the point, I say. Hazel is the target.
Yeah, at the auction. Mother won't have a chance. Everyone will be too busy fighting the society.
I hope he's right. The Royal Palace is lit up like a giant candle in anticipation of the auction tomorrow. I caught a miraculous glimpse of Hazel for the first time since she escaped, leashed and veiled. She was led to the motor car by the Duchess, but it was enough to make my heart soar. I have time. She is alive, and I'm going to make sure no one threatens her life again. We arrive at the same time as the Countess of the Rose. Her hair is piled up on her head and dotted with real roses. The Count leans heavily on a cane as he walks up the front stairs beside her. Her lady-in-waiting is an older woman with a topknot as grey as the Countess's own hair.
You are the talk of the circle, Pearl,
the Countess says with admiration. I listen attentively but keep my eyes on my sister. She glances back at me, and I give her the tiniest shake of my head. She gives me a minuscule nod and keeps her eyes forward.
Just what you've always wanted.
That is where you are wrong, my dear Amatrine, the Duchess replies, her gaze fixed on the front doors of the palace. There has only ever been one thing I truly wanted, and it wasn't winning the jewel's popularity contest.
As soon as we step inside, footmen take cloaks and hats and lead the royals away to the dining room. I keep my eyes on Hazel's retreating form for as long as I can. Just as they are about to turn a corner, she looks back at me one more time. Then she's gone.
Come along, Imogen,
Cora says. I turn and catch a glimpse of the Countess of the Stone making her way up the stairs with a short, frail man by her side. The Count, I assume. I wonder if Emile will be here tonight. I follow Cora and the older lady-in-waiting, both of whom clearly know where they're going, to a room with colourful couches in shades of peach, turquoise, emerald and lilac. Several tables have been laid out with all sorts of food and glass pitchers of water. There is one lady-in-waiting already here. He must serve the Duchess of the Scales. She's the only founding house I haven't seen yet.
Olivier, Cora says, coming over to greet him. How lovely to see you. Have you met Imogen?
Olivier is plump and cheery, with a carrot-orange topknot.
You were hired for Coral, yes? He says, shaking my hand.
His are unnaturally soft.
Yes, I say, but I serve Carnelian now. Such a shame, he says with a sigh, then directs his attention back to Cora. Your house has been hit hard these past few weeks. Turning the auction into an engagement party was a brilliant idea of the Exeter's. Just the thing this circle needs to lift its spirits.
I'm surprised the Duchess brought her surrogate here at all,
the grey-haired lady-in-waiting says, coming to join us with a plate of cheese and fruit.
Isn't she worried about the Electress?
Come now, Eloise,
Olivier says.
The Electress would never attempt to harm the surrogate in her own house.
I wouldn't put it past her,
a thin, dry voice says from the doorway. I know him, even without really having seen him before. Raven told me all about Frederick. His voice, his bloody gums, his beady eyes, his beaked nose. He glides into the room, plucking a grape off a bunch in a silver bowl.
Eloise, Olivier.
He acknowledges them with a nod. Glad to see you're up and about, Cora says dryly. We missed you at Garnet's party.
I was sorry not to be there,
Frederick says with a distinct lack of sincerity,
though I do like my soirees to come with a little less violence.
Really? Cora shoots back. I was under the impression it was quite the opposite. Eloise and Olivier look uncomfortable, but Frederick merely smiles at her, and I see them, the blood-red gums Raven told me about. It is a hideous smile, one that clearly wishes the receiver harm. Frederick pops the grape into a mouth and chews it slowly.
Will the Countess be buying another surrogate this year?
Olivier says in a blatant attempt to diffuse the tension.
Of course, Frederick says. Such a shame about the last one. It was truly unique.
Raven told me they used to call her It. Knowing it was one thing, but hearing him say it out loud, I ball my hands into fists, the desire to join with air and throw him across the room potent inside me. Ah, good. You are all here. I turn and see Lucian. Welcome, my friends. Another year, another auction, though this year seems to be shaping up a little differently than the previous ones. In more ways than one, I think. And his gaze lands on me for half a second, but in that time, I know his thoughts are in line with mine.
Indeed, Olivier agrees, bouncing on the balls of his feet. An engagement party and an auction. The entire jewel attending. No doubt the Duchess will be thrilled by the attention, Frederick says.
And the Countess is known for her humility, Cora retorts. We must be in top form, Lucian says, ignoring the snipes between the two. And keep close eyes on your mistresses. With all the violence and the distress in the lower circles, we must be on high alert. If I didn't know better, I'd think he was sincerely concerned with the well-being of the royal women. He snaps a finger at me. You, he says, Carnelian requires you. Come with me. My heart in my throat, I follow him out the door. I expect him to lead me far from the room with the other ladies in waiting, or maybe back to his secret workshop, but instead, he takes me only one room over. Do you know how to get to this room from the front doors? He asks. Yes, I say, surprised. It's just down the hall to the left, right? Correct. The room is a small antechamber, nothing in it except for a round blue rug and a painting of a white fluffy dog sitting on a plush stool. Lucian pulls back the painting to reveal a hole in the wall, large enough for me to climb through. I can see stone stairs on the opposite side. This will take you to my room, he says. I left markings for you to follow. I wanted to make sure you could find it if the time comes. My chest is tight. Lucian replaces the painting so nothing looks out of place. This is it, I say. This is it, he echoes in reply. He puts his hands on my shoulders. Whatever happens tomorrow, whatever the day brings, at least we tried. We tried to do something bold and brave. We tried to change the world, I say. He smiles gently. Or our own little corner of it, at least. I smile back. He has meant so much to me, and I don't know how to express my thanks for everything he has done. He seems to sense my feelings, though, and envelops me in a freesia-scented hug. As we walk back out into the hall, a footman rushes up. Lucian, come quick. Arabella has burned the venison pot pies, and Robert and Duncan are at each other's throats again. The kitchen is a nightmare. Lucian pinches the bridge of his nose. Oh, of all the nights, he mutters, and the two hurry down the hall, disappearing behind a tapestry. I'm left alone. I turn to re-enter the chamber where the food and ladies-in-waiting are, when a dancing glint of light catches my eye. A door across the hall with a golden handle is slightly ajar. Curiosity gets the better of me, and I push it open, slipping inside. The room is larger than I expected, and full of me. Mirrors hang on every wall, reflecting my startled face back at me. Except that it's not my face, not really. It's the face of a blonde girl with a high forehead and wide green eyes. It's the face of a stranger. I make a circuit of the room, my stranger's face appearing in an oval mirror inlaid with mother-of-pearl, a square-shaped one with golden roses fixed on its four points, and a long rectangle with pearls dotting its edge. I stop at one that sets my heart pounding, It's a simple square mirror, with a silver frame. But etched lightly in its centre is a tree that looks exactly like the lemon tree that grows in the backyard of my house in the marsh. The one that never produced a lemon until I used the third augury. Growth on it, when I visited my family on Reckoning Day. I grew a lemon for Hazel, to remember me by. And now she's sitting in a glitzy dining room on a leash, next to a woman who is planning to murder her tomorrow. I take one step back from the golden tree, then another and another, until I'm standing in the centre of the room. My reflection stares out at me with 100 pairs of eyes. This is not who I am, this blonde-haired girl in lady-in-waiting garb. I am Violet Lasting. I am one of the Paladin, and I could destroy this room if I wanted to. And I do want to. Desperately. I join with the element effortlessly, sweeping all the air in here to me, calling on it to do as I command. I feel it swirl around me, restless, waiting and eager. Break, I think. And my strong is so sharp, so intense, the image of what I desire strong and specific, like I'm conjuring an augury. But the elements are stronger than any augury. I shoot the air away from me, and it hits the centre of each mirror perfectly. I feel as if I'm flying in 100 different directions, as if I am reaching out with my own hands to imprint the pattern on each and every mirror in this room. All but one. I release the hold on the element to the sound of tinkling bits of glass clattering to the floor. The lemon tree mirror is as it was, perfectly smooth and reflective. In the centre of every single other mirror, the glass has cracked to form a very well-known, very specific shape. A skeleton key. I look around the room in awe. Keys surround me, fragmenting my face in grotesque fashions. I've never been so proud of myself, so sure of the power I possess. I have marked this room for the society, and tomorrow, the royalty will feel the weight of our fury.
23. The morning of the auction is crisp and clear. The sky is a perfect robin's egg blue, and the garden looks even lusher than usual. My fingers tremble as I lace up the back of Carnelian's dress, careful not to hurt her shoulder or ribs. I have to remind myself to breathe. "Are you all right?" she asks, when I fumble with the laces for the third time. "I'm fine," I say. I don't like the auction.
Right,
Carnelian grimaces. I finish getting her dressed in silence. Rye is waiting outside her room. He takes her arm with a strained smile.
What's wrong?
She asks.
There were some whispers in the kitchen,
he says, his eyes flashing to me for half a second. The hairs on the back of my neck prickle.
Something's happened. I don't know what. Everyone stopped talking when I came in.
Something happened with my aunt? Carnelian asks.
Something happened with my sister,
I want to demand. Rye shrugs. I'm not sure.
Then his whole demeanour shifts, like a light being turned on.
Are you excited to attend your first auction?
They chat as we walk to the foyer. I trail behind them, heart hammering, and when I see the Duchess's gleeful face, it pounds even faster. Anything that makes her look this happy can't be good. Whatever it is, Hazel appears to be safe for the time being. The Duchess has her on the leash, but she's dressed in an extravagant gown, blue and silver silk stitched with pearls and sapphires. Her face is veiled, and there is a delicate crown on her head, strands of gold woven with diamonds. Her purple eyes meet mine, and the look in them is fierce. She knows what this day means, even if she isn't aware of the plot for her murder. We take two motorcars to the auction house. Ours is thick with tension. Garnet is in his regimental uniform, and his leg won't stop jiggling. Rye's posture is a bit too forced to look casual. I stare out the window at the palaces flashing by, my mouth so dry it's uncomfortable to swallow. I wish I knew why the servants were worried, why the Duchess looks so excited. But I have to stay focused. I have to get to the train station underground. I waited all night for the Arcana to buzz, to hear Raven's voice, or Syl's, or Lucian's. But it stayed frustratingly silent. When we arrive at the auction house, there is a small platform set up on the lawn in front of it, with a smooth block of marble in its centre. inlaid with gold and rubies. I don't know what that's for. Ryan Carnelian seemed confused by it, and Garnet looks perplexed as well. Perplexed and frightened? The crowd is tense. None of the cheerful laughter and conversation I was expecting. The royals huddle together on the sprawling grass that surrounds the pink dome building, muttering urgently to one another. As we get out of the car, I catch snippets of what they're saying. Never could have imagined it. I'm having my lady-in-waiting interrogated the second I get home. And he was so helpful in securing me an invitation to the longest night ball last year. My pounding heart jumps to my throat and stays there, choking me. A feeling of dread creeps up my spine. Something is very wrong. We make our way through the crowd, and the royals fall silent at our approach, bowing and curtsying to the Duchess as she passes. When we are only a few yards from the marble block, the Countess of the Rose swoops over. "Did you hear?" she says, fanning herself with a pink feathered fan. "They've found him, the leader of that horrid Black Key Society." The second before she says the name stretches out to eternity. I wait in it, unable to blink or breathe, my body a living vessel of terror. "It's Lucian," the Countess of the Rose says. The ground shifts beneath my feet. I think I might be falling. A strong hand reaches out to steady me. It's Garnet. His face is barely masking his fear, and I realize we've got to do better. My world may have stopped turning in this moment, but there are so many worlds to consider on this day. We have to be strong. We have to be brave. I've almost convinced myself I can do it, until the executioner walks up the steps to the platform. He wears a black mask and carries a silver axe slung in his belt. I can't take my eyes off it, its sharp edge catching the light. My mind can't wrap my head around its purpose.
"Lucian?" the Duchess is asking incredulously. "I heard they caught the leader, but Lucian? He always seemed so..."
"Obedient,"
the Countess of the Stone looms over the Duchess, her large breasts spilling out of her bronze-coloured dress.
"It's always the ones you trust the most, isn't it?"
"How did they know?" the Duchess asks.
"Apparently he wanted to leave his mark in the royal palace itself. Smashed all the mirrors in the room of reflection with imprints of that key."
"The keys? My keys? Lucian must have taken the blame when they were discovered. I thought the world stopped spinning when I heard Lucian had been caught. It is nothing compared to knowing that he was caught because of me." The auction house swims in my vision. My lungs have shrunk to half their normal size. I can't get enough air. My fault. My fault. My fault. The royals keep talking, but all sounds have faded to a dull buzz. What was I thinking? Why did I do that? It was reckless and foolish. Lucian is neither of those things. He is careful and cautious. He is kind and generous. He saved my life. He showed me who I was and what I was capable of. He has watched over me like a brother, like a father. And I failed him. I ruined everything in one moment of arrogant idiocy. Trumpets blare, piercing through the fog of my mind. The Exeter and Electra step onto the platform, decked in crimson and black and gold, matching the crests pinned on their chests. The Electra's look shell-shocked. The Exeter is sombre. His eyes rest on the Duchess for a moment before he holds up a hand and the last remaining whispers fall silent. "My fellow royalty," he says in his rich tenor, "we have discovered a traitor among us."
He turns to someone standing off to the side where I can't see.
"Bring him out."
Garnet's hand moves to his pistol, but there's nothing either of us can do. It takes every ounce of self-control I have not to scream, to cry out to him, as Lucian is paraded onto the platform. One eye is bruised and swollen. There is a gash on his forehead, and he walks with a limp. Instead of his lady-in-waiting garb, he wears a burlap sack, tied around his waist with a length of rope. His feet are bare and dirty. His hands are bound, and he is flanked by two regimentals. One of them prods him in the back, and he stumbles, nearly losing his balance. The crowd laughs and jeers. They've shaved his head completely, his beautiful chestnut topknot gone. He looks so much younger without it. The regimentals march him to the marble block, and the Exeter speaks again.
This man, formerly known as Lucian of the Royal Palace, has been charged with treason and sedition. He has been discovered as the leader of the rebel society that calls itself the Black Key. He is responsible for all acts of violence committed in the lower circles, attacks against royal outposts, which is tantamount to an attack on the jewel itself. He has been found guilty of these crimes. The sentence is death.
I feel nauseous, my stomach churning as they force Lucian to his knees. My heart slams against my ribs, each thudding the same word repeating over and over in my head. No, 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 no! The Exeter turns to his former servant, a look of disgust on his face.
Do you have any last words before your sentence is carried out?
Lucian's deep blue eyes scan the crowd. They light on Garnet for an instant before they find me. Relief flickers across his face, as if he is glad I am here.
This is no one's fault but my own, he says, choosing his words carefully. I take full responsibility for my actions. I will not apologize for my crimes. They were done for love of my city, for the love I bear to all the people in it. The lower circles have been mistreated for too long. The royalty have taken our sons and daughters, forced them into servitude, destroyed hopes and dreams and lives purely for their own greed. It was time they paid the price. I am not ashamed of what I have done. His eyes land on me again. This is no one's fault but my own. I'm shaking my head, because it is. It is my fault, and the guilt is searing, blistering. It claws at my lungs, it shreds my heart to pieces. It should be me up there, not him. The city needs him. I need him. He gives me the softest smile, and I see the forgiveness in his eyes, and I hate myself more than I ever thought possible. I hate myself more than I hate the Duchess or the auction or this evil, glittering circle. When Lucian speaks again, it is as if we are alone, as if he is speaking just to me, the way he did the first day I met him in the prep room, the day my life changed. This is how it begins, he says, echoing the words his sister spoke so many months ago. In front of the walls of Southgate, a tiny smile lights on his lips. I am not afraid. Then he gently lays his head on the block, as if it were a pillow. I can't stop the tears that fill my eyes. They are hot and shameful, and I don't deserve to cry them. The axe makes a shimmering, whistling sound as it cuts through the air. Blood stains the white stone red, dripping over rubies and golden swirls. My whole body is paralysed. The crowd around me starts making noise again, but I can't make sense of anything. I watch regimentals carry Lucian's body off the platform. Another one follows behind with a basket. The marble block is removed, and the Exeter claps his hands and announces something. But all the sound has been sucked out of this place. The crowd swells forward, past the platform, towards the auction house, and I am swept up with them, walking woodenly on legs that don't remember how to work, that can't seem to understand the rules of a world without Lucian in it. I feel a soft pressure on my arm and blink up at Garnet. His eyes are filled with tears, and I realise I'm crying too. The Duchess leads Hazel in front of us on the leash, Ryan Carnelian right behind them. They seem stunned, confused, but their worlds have not been shattered like mine. Garnet nods towards the open doors of the auction house and fixes me with a fervent look. For him, he whispers. I thought I'd lost the power of speech, but my mouth works independently of my brain. For him, I whisper back. Garnet blinks and rubs his eyes, releasing his hold on my elbow. I wipe my face with my hands. There will be time to mourn for Lucian, to punish myself for the role I played in his death. But I will not fail him now, at what could be the end of everything. The foyer of the auction house is massive. The top of the dome is made of glass, light pouring down and spilling over the mosaic of tiles that decorate the floor. In the centre is a huge fountain, water spurting from the outstretched arms of a statue of Diamante the Great, the electress who started the first auction. Waiters skirt the crowds with glasses of pink and blue cocktails. The royals mingle, discussing the execution as if it were entertainment. I can't help but think of my own auction experience. This is what was happening while Lucian was prepping me, while I was in the waiting room with Dahlia. The Duchess sits on a raised dais off to one side, the Exeter in the centre, the Electress on his right. Hazel stands behind the Duchess, her eyes fixed on me, the collar shining in a cruel mockery of a necklace around her neck. I'm grateful that Larimer does not seem to be invited to his own engagement party. Perhaps the royals thought children would be in the way. Half an orchestra is playing, and there are jugglers and acrobats darting and dancing through the crowds, just like Coral had described. The regimentals that pick the surrogates up won't be down there for 10 more minutes, Garnet murmurs to me, his back turned so it doesn't look like we're talking. I had someone change the clocks, so they think they've still got time. The train should be pulling up any moment. You'd better hurry. Hazel, I say, glancing toward my sister. I know I need to go, but I don't want to leave her here. What if she is murdered before the whole thing starts? I'll keep an eye on her as long as I can, Garnet says. Go. My grief is melting away in the face of fear. This is really happening. Carnelian is engaged in conversation with Rye and the Countess of the Rose, and I take the opportunity to slip away. The train station is on the very lowest level of the auction house. I locate the door I need, the one I remember clearly from the blueprints. Facing south, third door on the left. It leads me to an antechamber that I cross, leaving through the door on the opposite side, where a set of stairs waits. I take it down, past the two floors of prep rooms, past the floor that holds the beehive-like rooms, where the surrogates are knocked unconscious to be transported to their new homes. Down, down, until the stairs end in a cold, concrete hallway. I quickly bring up the blueprints in my mind again. Right. I turn and run. There is a door, a big wooden one, that will take me to the station, to Raven and the others. I pass an industrial-sized elevator, used to transport unconscious surrogates to their prep rooms. Then I see the door. I slam into it, turning the handle and pushing it open just as the last train crawls into view. There are no conductors on these trains. They run automatically. I hope the girls have managed to take out the doctors and caretakers. The regimentals haven't arrived yet, just as Garnet said. The train screeches to a halt, steam issuing from its chimney and creating a soft mist in the air. One by one, iron doors slam shut behind each of the four trains, echoing with a loud clang in the cavernous space. The roof arches into a peak, stones fitted together in a puzzle of slate and charcoal and soft grey. Thick iron chandeliers hang from the ceiling on sturdy chains, glow globes emitting a rich yellow light. I don't have time to be cautious. Paladin! I cry. Violet! Raven's voice rips through me, a happiness more powerful than I thought I was capable of feeling in this moment. Her head pokes out of the plum-coloured Southgate train. Violet! She cries, and jumps down off the carriage. I can't stop the cry that escapes my lips. A tortured howl, really. I run across the station as she starts toward me, and we collide into each other. You're okay, she breathes into my ear, her hand scrabbling over my back to make sure I'm whole. Lucian's dead, I say, and it hits me then, like a punch in the chest. Lucian is dead. What? Raven gasps, but I don't have time to explain, because heads are popping out of train cars and girls are filling the room, eyes wide as they take in the huge space. Violet, someone says, and then my name is picked up and echoes through the train station. Violet! Violet is here! Violet! I want to cry. I want to gather them all up in an enormous hug. I want to shout orders, to tell them to forget the wall. We are taking the whole auction house down right now. We are punishing the royalty for killing the man who is 10 times a human any of them are or will ever be.
Violet, you're all right.
Indy engulfs me in one of her hugs.
I'd forgotten about your hair and your face. You don't look at all like you.
Sienna and Olive join us, Syl bringing up the rear. We heard about Coral, Sienna says. At the same time, Olive asks,
Have you seen my mistress?
Lucian's dead, I say again, the words coming easier this time as my body begins to accept the reality of that fact. Syl's face goes blank with utter shock. Indy gasps, and Sienna covers her mouth with her hands, Even Olive looks upset. It's my fault, I gasp. All my fault. I only have eyes for Syl in this moment. I did something stupid and he took the blame for it. I should never. I didn't mean. The tears begin to fall thick and fast. Syl strides forward and takes my chin in her hands.
Stop crying, she says sharply. Look at me.
She holds me in her steely silver gaze.
That man loved you more than anything in this world. You can't do a single damn thing to bring him back, but you can honour who he was and what he did right here, right now. These girls need you, Violet.
She sweeps a hand out over the 77 girls who were meant to be unconscious, sold into slavery, but instead have gathered around me, faces bright and determined.
They are here and alive, and they need you, she murmurs.
77 pairs of eyes stare at me, waiting for instructions. Girls ranging in age from 13 to 19 looking to me for guidance. Syl is right. I take a deep breath.
We've got to divide up, I say.
Raven, Syl, Indy, Olive, you'll be in charge of each team. Make sure you've got every element. Sienna, you're with me. Sienna flicks her lighter open, making the flame burn bright. Then I turn to the waiting faces, and for the first time, I really see them. Amber is there, looking at me with a clenched jaw and resolute face. Tawny, Ginger, and Henna are right beside her. I see Slo, a beautiful girl with russet skin and dark arching eyebrows, the leader of the Northgate girls. She throws her hair over her shoulder in her typical haughty fashion. Little Rosie Kelting, a 14-year-old girl from Eastgate, chews her lip as she awaits instructions. So many faces, so many names. Strong, beautiful girls. Paladin.
Southgate to Raven, I call. Northgate to Syl. Eastgate to Olive. Westgate.
I'm interrupted by a flat piece of stone wall sliding open. A regimental steps out, and for a second I panic. But the glint of blonde hair under his cap makes my chest swim with relief.
What are you doing here? I demand, walking over to greet Garnet. You were supposed to...
But all my panic returns when I am close enough to see his face. It isn't Garnet. Hidden doors are all around us, clicking like insects as they slide open. Regimentals pouring out of them, a wall of red. We are surrounded.
24. Surprise seems to be our one advantage. The blonde regimental is staring at me, mouth open, like he's never seen a girl before. The room is a powder keg, waiting to explode. The instant someone moves, the spell will be broken. My knees bend slightly as I prepare myself to light the spark. There is stone all around us, water beneath us, air everywhere. Sienna has her lighter.
Who in the Exeter's name are you? The regimental says.
I am Violet Lasting, I say calmly. Then I take a deep breath and cry,
Paladin!
I join with air instinctively, gathering all the molecules of air in this room toward me, condensing and compacting them. Then I release them, like a stone from a slingshot, at the blonde regimental still gaping at me. The force of it is so powerful, he is slammed into the far wall and slumps to the ground, unconscious.
Syl, earth! I shout. Indy, water!
There is a rumble underfoot as the floor begins to shake. Syl shouts for the girls who can join with Earth, but the regimentals are running toward them, despite the unsteady ground. I send two flying, but a third has drawn his gun and is pointing it straight at my head. This is it, I think. Maybe I'll get to see Lucian again, and my father. Then the regimental is engulfed in flames. His screams stun everyone temporarily as I turn and see Sienna, lighter in hand, a murderous expression on her face. We nod to each other as a crater opens up at our feet. Syl and Amber and five other girls focusing on the ground. Two regimentals fall into it as the crater deepens, searching for the water down below. Sienna sends a snaking coil of fire toward a regimental, aiming his gun at Slo.
Don't shoot to kill, one of them calls out to the others. The royalty need them alive.
Are you crazy?
One shouts back as another cries. What's happening? The crater hits water. I can smell it. I can feel its writhing fluid force.
Finally!
Indy sighs. She's with 7 other girls, and they condense the water the way I've condensed air, forming it into a thick white jet and shooting it across the hall. It hits one regimental hard in the face, and his neck snaps back. Others raise their hands to cover their eyes as the jet splits into 7, and regimentals start slipping on the wet floor. I'm still connected with air when I hear the bullet. I don't know if I make the conscious decision or somehow the element does it for me, but it whizzes by my ear, nicking my lobe, and then sharply shifts direction, landing in the shoulder of an oncoming regimental. I ignore the sting of pain and the feel of blood dripping down my neck. My eyes land on the chandelier hanging from the ceiling.
Earth! I cry. The walls!
Syl and I make eye contact, and I jerk my head to the light fixture. Slow joins us, then Amber, adding her own force to our might, so that the cracks begin to snake up the walls and then across the ceiling.
Back up! Back up!
I shout, and the paladins scatter toward the door as the chandelier sways precariously over the main force of regimentals. There is a loud crack, and it falls, delicately at first, a beautiful swirl of light and metal. I grab Syl's hand and run, barreling right into Slow and getting all 3 of us out of the way just as the chandelier crashes down. The noise is deafening. It bounces off the walls, magnified 10-fold, so that my eardrums feel as if they might pop. Hunks of stone and iron fly everywhere. Syl and I use air to deflect the larger stones away from the girls. Slow is trembling underneath me.
You're okay, I say. My ears are ringing faintly, and I'm reminded of how I felt after the explosion in the bank.
I lift my head and survey the damage. It seems as though most of the girls made it to the door, but there are bodies littered around and under the rubble. A girl with curly hair lies a few feet away from me, her neck twisted at an unnatural angle, a bullet hole in her chest. I don't recognize her. She must have been one of the last ones in the holding facilities to gain her powers when I was already in the duel. Regimental bodies are everywhere.
Raven,
I croak, sitting up. Dust settles in my hair and on my lashes.
Raven!
I'm all right,
she stands up, shaking the dust from her hair.
Sienna? Indy? Olive?
I call. I hear a cough and Sienna's braided hair emerges from behind a chunk of rubble.
We're fine!
Indy pops up beside her, her pale skin smudged with grey. I see Olive rubbing her eyes blearily.
That was a very good idea,
Indy says. That was only the beginning, I say. This number of regimentals is a fraction of what's guarding the auction house. As I look around the ruined station, though, I think, we may be small in number, but we are a force to be reckoned with. Then I add, Lucian, wherever you are, I hope you're seeing this. Syl, Raven, Indy, Olive, I say, get everyone to the wall. You remember the way, right? They nod in unison. Fire won't do much, but maybe you can use the water here. Earth and air will be crucial. This wall is thick, really thick.
We know, Slow says. We saw it.
Where will you go, Violet? Amber asks.
I catch Sienna's eye. We're going to signal to the rest of this city that it's time. Let's show the royalty that they can't control us anymore. Several girls whoop and cheer, but Syl shouts,
Quiet!
The Countess, Raven says to me with pleading eyes. She's here, I promise her, with Frederick. Don't worry. You'll have your chance, but these girls need you now. They'll follow you. I turn to Sienna. Let's go. I lead everyone out the door and back to the stairs I took to get down here. As we climb, adrenaline pumping through me with each step. I wonder if the royalty felt the earth shudder as the chandelier crashed down, or if they are still blissfully unaware of the danger that is about to befall them. There is a door to the outside on the lower floor of prep rooms, right at ground level.
Be careful,
I whisper to Raven. She beckons to Indy to follow. The other girls are so quiet, even the ones who look frightened. They file out into the hall, determined and alert. Syl is the last to leave.
We'll see you up there,
she says, pointing above us, where the spire waits. I grip her shoulder for a brief moment, then she's gone. Sienna and I climb up another floor to the top level of prep rooms. There will be regimentals here for certain. The lower level is used only when lots of surrogates are being auctioned, but this level is in use every year. I pause behind the door and listen. I can make out at least three different voices. Regimentals. I grab the handle and nod to Sienna's lighter. We need a distraction. The flame bursts up, a fiery orange. I open the door and she sends the fire racing down the halls. We hear screams and cries as the regimentals guarding prep room doors run from the blaze. We wait a few seconds, then enter the hall. Flames devour the carpet and climb the walls, but the hallway is empty. Sienna and I quickly put the fire out together. I see the door we need and throw it open with air, the handle too hot to touch. This staircase is narrow, with slitted windows, and it curls up in a spiral. We start to climb, up and up and up, and when we reach the top of it, I can see the pink curve of one of the smaller domes of the auction house, a few feet below us out the window. If I crane my neck, I can see the wall. There's a short hallway that takes us to a long ladder. I go first, tying the skirts of my lady-in-waiting gown so I don't step on them. Sienna wears pants. The rungs pose no problem for her. Halfway there, my arms are aching and my breath comes out in heavy pants. I can hear Sienna gasping behind me, but neither of us complains or slows our pace. I know we're close when I hear the wind whistling shrilly above us. We climb out onto a tiny round landing made of the same golden material as the spire that surrounds us. As I stand up and look around, I find myself grateful that I'm not afraid of heights. The spire is hollow, thin strips of gold shooting up into a point and forming a sort of cage around us. We are a few feet above the top of the wall and can see its vastness stretching out before us.
Whoa,
Sienna breathes. I agree. The wall is immense and maybe 50 yards away. I look down and see the figures of the paladin on the swathe of green lawn that separates the auction house from the wall. Indy's blonde hair is easily identifiable, and I watch Raven lining girls up on the grass.
It's so big, Sienna says.
It is, I say. Are we really going to bring it down? I grit my teeth. Ash promised me he'd be behind that wall, with Oka and so many society members. Lucian was counting on me. I can't fail them now. I won't.
We will.
Come on, I say, motioning to her lighter. First things first. It's time to give the society members the signal to set off the bombs. She flicks it and the flame shoots up.
Brighter,
I say, and the fire glows until it hurts to look at it. The wind whips Sienna's braids around her face and tugs at the strands in my bun, stinging my eyes. I connect with air and it plucks the lighter from her hands, carrying it through the slats of gold. I lift it up, high into the sky, where it hangs like a tiny sun. Then I feel along the cracks in the lighter, and in a burst of dazzling light, it explodes. I hold my breath. 10 seconds pass. 20. I watch as the last embers die, whisked off by the wind, scraps of metal from the ruined lighter falling to the lawn below. Another 20 seconds pass. Nothing. I wasn't sure what to expect, but I assumed there would be an immediate answer to the flare. My stomach begins to sink, fear seeping in. Sienna voices my concern.
Do you think they didn't?
Suddenly, there is a deafening boom, and a fireball blossoms far away in the centre of the bank. Glass sparkles like fireworks in the sun. The society's bombs are going off. 30 seconds later, I think I see a plume of black rising up from the smoke. The farm is too far away to know whether the bombs went off or not. I reach out and grip Sienna's hand.
Ready?
I ask for the second time. She squeezes mine tight, no snarky comment on her lips, only hard, cold resolve mingled with a hint of fear. I connect with air again and shout,
Now!
Pushing my voice down so that it swoops around the line of girls waiting on the lawn below. Then I release my hold on air and switch to earth. I can feel the heat of Sienna's hand in mine, a comforting warmth at odds with the heavy pull in my chest from the wall. These stones are old, and they've been standing for a long time. I feel as each girl who can connect with Earth joins us. I think I hear Raven's shouts of encouragement, but maybe I'm just imagining that. The wall is heavy, so very, very heavy. I try to break cracks into the stones. I can feel Sienna fighting with me, and Syl and Amber, and all the other Earth girls. but it's so hard. As the minutes tick by, I begin to fear the wall is impenetrable. My shoulders ache with effort. Lucian was wrong. My plan is doomed. I am not the leader he thought I could be. It doesn't matter how many paladin I convince to join us. I've led them to failure. Don't you give up, honey. Lucian's voice whispers in the back of my mind, as crystal clear as if he were standing right next to me. I know you can do this. I knew from the day I met you. I think I love you. Ash's words ring out alongside Lucian's. You found me, Raven murmurs, the salty tang of the ocean filling my nose. Let's hope she's everything you think she is, Syl growls, or we'll be living like cockroaches under a rock for the rest of our damn lives. My heart begins to beat faster, swelling with each new voice I hear. These people are the air I breathe and the blood I bleed. They are my courage. I will not let them down. I know you can do this. Lucian believed in me, always. I hold that thought close, and for the first time, I try to believe it too. No, not try. I can do this. I am stronger than I think I am. My legs and arms are filled with the heaviness of the rocks beneath me. My torso is made of stone, my eyes tiny pebbles that grind against my skull. My heart beats out a powerful rhythm in my chest, swelling with each new thud, and I grip Sienna's hand even tighter. The power flowing in my veins feels as ancient as this very wall, as I accept it into me, as I believe in it. I spread it out to Sienna, filling both of us with a heat like fire, and a drive like flowing water, and the force of a windstorm. I am all of the elements, and I can sense each of the girls below me, the little lights of their magic glowing like candle flames. I pour everything I have into them, the way I did that night I saved Raven. I pour out all my love, my hope for a better life, a better world. I infuse them with my belief that they are strong enough. I am the strongest of them all, and I radiate that might out to them. We are the paladin. We are more powerful than rock and stone. I know it now. We are the protectors of this island. I brush the last cobwebs of fear from my mind. I focus everything I am into this huge swathe of wall, and Sienna does too. So do the girls on the ground. The first crack appears, and though I can't see it, I feel it in my chest. Sienna gasps, accepting this raw, pulsing power. I have never felt so strong or so alive. And I see that Lucian's original plan of using only me to tear down the wall never would have worked. It takes all of us, working together. No one paladin could do this on her own. With a great groan, a whole section of the wall begins to collapse, as hunks of rock and clouds of dust rain down. I release my hold on the element and grab one of the golden spires. The thunderous avalanche of stone drowns out the sound of my panting. Sienna covers her ears, crouching beside me. But we're not done yet. I join with air and scream, "Air!" My voice swooping over the girls below. Air is ready and eager to help. Sienna watches as we lift chunks of stone and rubble, heaving them into the remaining parts of the wall, clearing the way for the fighters standing by in the bank. I see Indy raise her hand, and then a wave of water bursts up out of the ground, pouring over the opening we made. A vast river clearing away the royalty's main defence. The wind picks up a faint cheer rising from the other side of the wall. I release my hold on air as the cheer grows louder. People climb through the opening, braving the water, which slows at their entrance. I catch glimpses of white fabric tied around arms. I look for Ash, but there are too many people, and I'm too high up. But I do see Syl turn and shout something. I follow her gaze. At least 100 regimentals are swarming out of the auction house as a volley of gunshots rings out. Men and women fall to the ground and don't get up. "We have to get down there," I cry. Sienna and I quickly climb down the ladder, jumping the last several feet onto the landing, then back down the spiral staircase until we reach the first floor of prep rooms. Regimentals are everywhere, streaming down the hall to the fight. We crouch in the doorway as they rush past us. Sienna's lighter is gone, so we can't use fire as a distraction again. But I am one of the paladin, and I am not afraid. I take a deep breath and join with air, gathering it to me in a gust so strong it blows the hats off the regimental's heads. Then I push it out, more forcefully than I ever have before, toppling them like dominoes. And Sienna joins with earth so that the ground shakes and pieces of the ceiling cave in. We crash out into the hall, climbing over prostrate regimentals, dropping more pieces of the ceiling on them with earth and throwing them back with air. Sienna is stronger than she was, too. It's as though bringing the wall down imbued us with more power than we ever thought we possessed. The doors to the lawn have been blown off their hinges, and we dive through them into the fray. The rosy facade of the auction house is pockmarked with bullet holes. A bullet whizzes by me, and I deflect it, still connected with air, into the leg of a nearby regimental. Bodies litter the ground, staining the green lawn a dark, rusted red. Regimentals, society members with white armbands, paladin. I see little Rosie Kelton's body, her eyes vacant in death. Indy is swirling water this way and that, blasting the enemy out of the way, while Syl tosses huge chunks of rock with air. Garnet has tied a band around his arm and is leading a group of rebel regimentals fighting hand to hand with dual regimentals, Raven by his side, holding her own, her body strong and fluid as she fights. I search for Ash desperately in the melee, but there are too many people and too much chaos. Rye is a black and white blur. He moves so quickly it's hard to keep track of him. A few other companions are fighting with him, also dressed in tuxes, looking beautiful and terrifying. One has gotten his hand on a sword, and he slashes the throat of an enemy regimental, a bright red spray splashing across his tuxedo shirt. More white-banded rebels pour through the opening in the wall, forcing the regimentals back toward the auction house. One of them points his gun at Syl, and Indy hits him with a blast of water so forceful he slams into the auction house wall. Suddenly, a shot rings out. It's one of so many I'm surprised I can identify it specifically through the din. I feel it more than I see it, as it speeds across the lawn toward Indy. In a flash, I push a gust of air toward it, but I'm too late. I can't make sense of the way her head tilts backward, or the spray of red that explodes out of her beautiful blonde hair. She falls almost gracefully to the ground, her tall, lithe body twisting and swaying. She lands with a thump and doesn't get up. Indy! I scream, pelting across the grass. Bullets are flying, but my anger makes me strong, and with a wave of my hand, air sends them all shooting in another direction, scattering into the wall and regimentals behind me. Indy's eyes are open. She stares up at the clear blue sky with a slightly surprised expression. Lips parted, hair tumbled about her face. A pool of blood begins to ooze out from the back of her head, turning her golden strands crimson. 20 or so regimentals are approaching me from the auction house. I stare them down with a fury unlike I have ever known, one that grows with every pulse of my heart.
"Bury them!"
I shriek. My rage is white-hot fire. I join with earth so quickly and completely that I feel as if I have been built into the very foundations of this palace, into the roots of the grass and down below, to where this island meets the ocean. I will destroy each and every one of them. I feel Sienna join with earth as well, then another girl, and another. Clicking into place like puzzle pieces, our power increasing as more of us are focused on the same thing. The auction house makes a strange groaning sound. The regimentals are bewildered. One shoots another girl connected with earth in the chest. And as she falls, I feel the loss of her. Her bright light snuffed out so quickly. Bury them, I think again, and the entire south wall of the auction house collapses. The regimentals have a split second to run, not nearly enough time. The rose-coloured stone crashes down on top of them, glass windows shattering, so that an entire side of the auction house is nothing but a gaping hole. I can see the remnants of the amphitheatre where I was sold. It's been broken in half. The fancy chairs and chaise longues toppled. Ruined. There is nothing left but dust and bodies. And still the members of the society swarm through the open wall. Sienna runs over to where I'm kneeling beside Indy.
No,
she murmurs. She cups Indy's cheek in one hand, a remarkable tender gesture. Other girls are gathering around the bodies of their fallen friends, some crying, some rocking the dead back and forth as if it will soothe them, as if they could be soothed. I watch numbly as a squad of handsome young men splashes through the ruins of the wall, through the river Indy made only half an hour ago. Then I hear a voice, so achingly familiar, it's the only sound that could reach me in this well of anger and despair. Violet!
Ash!
I gasp. I'm on my feet and running, pushing people out of the way to find him. And there he is. His hair is even longer, and rough stubble covers his cheeks. He wears a black shirt, the white band standing out starkly on his arm, a rusty, dented sword in his hand. He is facing the wrong way, still calling my name, searching the crowd. For a split second, I wonder if he'll even recognize me, if he'll remember I look different. Then he turns and his gaze lands on me. The sword drops from his hands and falls onto the grass.
Violet,
he says, and I can't hear him, but I know it's my name on his lips. He walks toward me, slowly at first, then faster. Then I'm running too, and we crash into each other in a tangle of arms and tears. He smells like blood and sweat, with a faint tinge of gunpowder. The stubble on his jaw is rough, but I press my face against it, holding him tighter than I need to, feeling his chest rise and fall against mine, drinking him in, almost delirious with joy. "You're alive," he whispers in my ear, breathless with the same elation I feel.
"I'm sorry," I whisper. "I'm so sorry, Ash. I should have believed in you."
"It's all right," he murmurs. "You're alive." And then he starts laughing, his chest heaving, and I'm laughing too, though I don't know why.
"Ochre?"
I gasp, pulling away from him. "Is he?" "He's fine," Ash says. "He and a few other boys have been confusing the regimentals in the bank, leading them to the wall where the society was waiting." Relief washes over me. My brother is safe. Now I need to help my sister.
"Lockwood!"
A companion in a tux comes running up to him, Garnet by his side.
"The regimentals have fled. Some are still inside the auction house, but we fear others are shoring up the rest of the jewel. We think many of the royals are dead or in their safe rooms, but we don't know how many more could be hiding in the palaces."
"Search every floor," Ash says. "Imprison as many as you can, but anyone who resists, we shoot to kill." He gazes through the opening in the wall, toward the bank. "We need more help."
"You need Paladin," I say. I turn and call out to Sienna, Syl, and Olive.
"Syl, take as many girls who can connect with earth and air as you can. We need the rest of this wall taken down. Sienna, get your own group together. Go with our regimental force and search the jewel for more royals. Olive, you gather some girls and go with the companions to clean up the auction house." Sienna immediately rushes off to find Slo and a few other girls she knows. Olive claps her hands and says,
"My mistress might be in there,"
before forming her own little group. "We're going in there too," I say, turning to Ash. "I think Hazel is still inside." Ash is staring at me with a look of wonder on his face.
"What?"
I say. He flashes me my favourite secret smile.
"You're incredible."
"You're pretty impressive yourself," I say, nodding toward the companions gathered around us.
"You'll have to tell me everything once this is all over."
"Once this is all over," he agrees. "Let's get your sister." He turns to the waiting companions, regimentals and society members, and begins giving quick orders. I move toward the auction house, impatient.
"Where's Raven?"
Garnet asks suddenly. I look around, but in the swarm of bodies, I can't find my best friend anywhere. Then I look up. I know exactly where she is heading, because we studied these blueprints for months, and the only place she made sure she knew the location of backward and forward and every which way was the Countess of the Stone's safe room.
"There," I say, pointing to the turret that holds the Founding House safe rooms.
"That's where she'll go." Garnet swears under his breath.
"Is she crazy?"
I look at him, then Ash. I'm not leaving my sister abandoned in that awful place, or my best friend to face the Countess on her own.
Let's go.
25. The main doors are hanging off their hinges, as if a stampede of people blasted through without bothering to open them first. Olive's group follows us inside, along with a crew of companions. Ash has his sword in hand again, and Garnet keeps his pistol at the ready. The main foyer is a mass of death and destruction, The fountain has broken in half, water spilling across the mosaic of tiles, carrying the blood of the fallen royals, regimentals, and servants in delicate red swirls. We cross the foyer, and I see the electresses among them, still on the dais. She looks so young in death. There is a gaping wound across her chest, but the Duchess and my sister are nowhere to be found. Neither is Raven. Suddenly, there is a shriek from across the room.
Mistress!
Olive cries. The Lady of the Stream is huddled behind the orchestra stand with a few other frightened royals.
Mistress, it's me! Oh, I found you at last! Get away from me!
The lady screams, and just as Olive reaches her, arms outstretched, the lady grabs a cornet off the platform and swings it hard. It connects with the side of Olive's head, and she drops like a stone. One of Olive's friends wails. The next second, the water rises up, as a hand-picked group of paladin retaliates, blasting the royals while the companions surge forward to finish the job. Olive's face still has the remnant of a smile, her joy at seeing her mistress one last time forever etched on it. So much death. So many lives ended today. I turn away to face Garnet and Ash. Raven will try to get into the Countess's safe room, and Hazel might be with the Duchess in her own safe room.
So they'll be right next to each other, Garnet says.
I close my eyes, picturing the dotted lines and patterns that I work so hard to memorize. This way, I say, and we take off, leaving the carnage behind us. We barge through a door made of blackened wood, then down a hall lined with pretty sconces and papered in gold and white, when we come upon Raven, grappling with a regimental. Garnet lets out a strangled yell and barrels forward, knocking both Raven and her attacker to the ground. Raven rolls to one side and is on her feet as Garnet hits the regimental in the temple with the butt of his gun. The man falls unconscious.
What are you doing?
Garnet demands, standing up to face her. She stares him down.
I have to,
she insists.
I know, he says. I just don't understand why you didn't wait for us.
Raven opens her mouth as another regimental comes running down the hall. I slam him into a wall with air. The safe rooms are up this way, I say, opening a door to reveal a set of curving stone stairs. Two regimentals are guarding it, and I deflect their bullets, still connected with air, as Ash takes them out with his sword. As we climb, we pass other safe rooms, for lesser royals. The Founding House safe rooms are in the very top of this turret. Every room is sealed tight, keeping the royalty inside. Hopefully these ones won't trouble us any longer, won't try to fight now that their precious regimental force is being battered and their wall is destroyed. We reach the top, where there are five doors, each with a crest: Scales, Royal Palace, Rose, Lake, Stone. I focus on the House of the Lake first, get Hazel, then help Raven. Stand back, I say. I gather all the air here to me, then expel it like I did to open the door with the hot handle. The door bursts open, revealing a small, beautifully decorated room behind it. It's empty.
She's not here, I gasp. She's not...
The Countess, Raven begs. Please. My head spinning, I focus air on the door with the House of the Stone's crest, a grey square crossed with two bronze hammers. The blast hits the door and rips it off its hinges. I send it flying across the room, and there is a loud crash as it bursts through a window on the opposite wall. Why do they even have windows in these safe rooms, I think, as the inhabitants inside cower and cough. Glass is littered around on the floor of a room as pretty as the one with the Duchess's crest. We charge inside. The frail man I saw briefly at the last royal dinner cowers behind the door.
Please, he stammers, don't hurt me.
What do you want?
The Countess demands, her eyes widen.
Garnet!
At your service, Garnet says, touching his cap.
What is going on here?
Frederick demands, rising up from behind a sofa.
How did you...
But Raven has stalked over to him, and in one swift movement, winds up and punches him hard in the face. I can hear the nose break. Blood spurts out from between his fingers as he clutches his injured face, howling and stumbling backward. Then she turns to the Countess.
Hello, Ebony, she says.
I love my friend. I saved her life once, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. But the look on her face as she stares down the Countess of the Stone is frightening. It sends a chill up my spine and makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end. There is a bruised swelling on Raven's left cheek and several long scratches down her neck, giving her a slightly wild appearance. The Countess looks, very appropriately, as though she is staring at a ghost.
"You're dead,"
she gasps. Raven gestures to her. "No, I'm not." The Countess pulls herself together quickly.
"When this whole thing is over, I'm going to have you dismembered, 192.
"My name," Raven says carefully, enunciating each word, "is Raven Sterling. And your time of torture and mutilation and cruelty is at an end." I see Frederick move out of the corner of my eye, and I'm about to cry out a warning. Garnet moves with me, raising his pistol. But Raven is faster than both of us, almost as if she anticipated this. She ducks and whirls, so that where once he was behind her, now she is behind him. She grips his head between her hands. "Oh, Frederick," she says, "I have been thinking about this reunion for such a very long time." Then, with a sharp twist, she snaps his neck. He crumples to the floor like a rag doll, his head bent at an odd angle.
"No!"
the Countess shrieks. Raven steps over his corpse without giving it a second glance. The Countess glares at her.
"You don't honestly think you will win this, do you?"
She looks around the room.
"What is your revolution made of? A handful of disgruntled servants, disgraced companions and farm workers, and one pathetic royal."
"Have you looked out that window?" Raven says. "Your forces are scattered. Your wall is broken. The circles will be integrated. The people of this city will take it back from you tyrants."
"The people of this city will be lost if it weren't for the royalty,"
the Countess says.
"They need us to survive."
"No," Raven says. "We don't." She touches her scalp, feeling each scar one by one. "You gave me such a gift, Ebony, and you didn't even realize it."
"Do not call me by my given name,"
the Countess snarls. Raven ignores her. "I can hear things now, you see. I know you were afraid. More afraid than you were that time your mother starved you for a week because you still hadn't lost weight. She locked you in the dungeon and wouldn't let you out. You cried yourself to sleep every night." There is an evil gleam in Raven's eye at the look of terror on the Countess's face. "Oh, yes. I've heard your secrets. I know your thoughts. You can't go digging around in someone's brain and not expect there to be repercussions, especially not a paladin brain." The Countess's brow furrows and Raven cocks her head. "That's what we are," she says. "Not surrogates, not slaves. But you knew, didn't you, that we were different? You were smart to fear us. Of course, you wouldn't call it fear. You called it, what? Curiosity? Experimentation? But deep down, you knew there was something about us, something about the auguries, that was dangerous if unleashed." She takes another step closer. The Countess stumbles back toward the broken window.
"I'm not afraid of you."
"Yes, you are," Raven says, her voice as deadly as a snake's hiss.
"And you should be."
Another step forward for Raven, another step back for the Countess. Then she closes the distance between them in a flash. The Countess's eyes widen in surprise, her large mouth dropping open as Raven shoves her out the window. She disappears with a shriek, falling to crash into the ground far below. The room is silent, except for the whimpering of the Count. Raven stands in the window, staring at the spot where the Countess vanished, her chest heaving.
"She's gone,"
she whispers to no one, or maybe to herself, confirming it aloud so she can truly believe it's real. Her knees give out and she falters. Garnet is by her side in an instant, sweeping her into his arms.
"She's gone,"
Raven sobs into his chest.
"She is," he murmurs into her hair. "She can't hurt you anymore. She can't hurt anyone ever again."
Raven takes a deep, shuddering breath and looks up into his eyes. They stare at each other for a long moment. Garnet gently traces a line around the bruise on her cheek with his finger. It's such a deeply personal thing to witness. I have to look away. out the door to where the empty safe room for the House of the Lake reminds me this day isn't over yet. The Duchess still has Hazel, I say. Ash nods. Where would they go? He asks. To the Palace of the Lake? One of the palaces nearby?
No, Garnet says with grim resignation. I bet I know exactly where she's gone. Follow me.
We run back down the stairs into the bloody foyer and out the ruined front doors.
This way,
Garnet says, pointing to where lines of motorcars wait to pick up royals who are never leaving this auction house again. We sprint to a car, Garnet and Raven in the front, Ash and I in the back seat. Garnet rips out the ignition and plays with the wires until the engine roars to life. We speed through the mostly empty streets of the Jewel, catching glimpses of befuddled servants and bursts of fighting among regimentals and society members. Many of the palaces, I note, are being looted, their gates broken down, their windows smashed.
Where are we going? Raven asks.
Suddenly, the earth shakes beneath us, the motorcar skidding on the paved road. In the distance, smoke and dust rise up, then a few hunks of rubble are lobbed through the air. Sill, I say with satisfaction, and Ash's fingers close around mine. You can bring them all down, he says. Every wall in this city. Lucian will be so proud. My throat closes up. Lucian's dead, I say. Ash looks confused for a second, like those two words don't make sense together. Then his lips form a thin line and he blinks very fast.
Oh, is all he says. Garnet, where are we going? Raven demands again. The Royal Palace, Garnet says through gritted teeth.
The home the Duchess always wanted, but was just out of her reach. The place she felt she was destined to have as her own.
Of course, I murmur.
26. Garnet slams the accelerator down, and we peel through the streets. The palaces whip by until we are in the forest, a blur of greens and browns, then past the topiary, until finally he pulls up in front of the fountain of trumpeting boys. The doors of the royal palace are open. When we get inside, the halls are empty.
I'll bet my entire inheritance she's gone to the throne room,
Garnet says. Which way? I ask, and he takes off down the opulent main hallway. We pass the ballroom, where I played cello at the Exeter's ball, and I glimpse the garden where I spoke to Ash in the gazebo that same night, before we make a sharp left. The sound of voices stops us in our tracks. Garnet holds up a hand and we creep to the end of the hall, the plush carpet muffling our footsteps. He peers around the corner, then pulls his head back quickly.
Seven reg, he mouths.
Ash withdraws his sword as Garnet upholsters his gun. Raven crouches into a fighting stance. I join with air, and for 1 second, I allow myself to revel in the blissful freedom of the element. Then I focus it, calling the wind to me from the 100 halls in this palace, and it comes whistling and shrieking. Garnet, Ash, and Raven whirl around the corner as I send it flying at the regimentals. What happens next is a blur. Crunches and shouts and thuds. Ash's sword sings through the air, guns go off, and all the while I fill the room with wind so fierce and biting it makes my own eyes burn and water. When I hear Ash shout, "Stop!" I release my hold on the element and everything settles. Regimentals are splayed out everywhere, some dead, some only unconscious. The room has an arched ceiling painted with murals depicting the four seasons, and stained glass windows as tall as Garnet, their jewel tones spilling across the black and white tile floor. In the centre of the room is a dais on which sit two immense opulent thrones. The arms are scaled and end in snake heads, with rubies for eyes. Enormous golden wings spread out from either side of each throne, and their seats are covered in crimson velvet. The Duchess sits in one, her skirts tangled about her legs, looking utterly nonplussed at this latest development. Her fingers grip the snakes like claws when she sees her son.
Garnet, she gasps.
Hazel is on the floor beside her, still leashed. Her face lights up when she sees me. Cora and Carnelian are behind her. Cora gapes at Garnet, but Carnelian only has eyes for Ash.
Hello, Mother, Garnet says, as if they've just sat down to breakfast. Not your typical auction day, is it? You.
You're with them.
The Duchess spits out the word. Her gaze lands on Raven, then Ash, then me.
Fighting with whores and servants.
You mean fighting alongside human beings? Garnet says.
Yes, Mother, I am.
The Duchess sneers.
I shouldn't be surprised. You're more like your father than you ever were like me.
Garnet pretends to consider for a moment.
I'll take that as a compliment.
You'd rather be a weakling.
Better a weakling than a murderer, I say, stepping forward. The Duchess stands, and I see she holds a dagger in one hand, presumably the same one the Exeter gave her. Its handle is studded with gemstones, its blade engraved with swirling lines of silver.
I will not suffer a mere lady-in-waiting to speak to me in such manner. When this ridiculous rebellion is over, I will have your tongue cut out. I will have your head on a spike. I will.
You will have nothing, I say, walking forward slowly. You have no power in this city, and I am no mere lady-in-waiting. I will not be afraid of her any more, and she will see me for who I truly am. Once to see it as it is, twice to see it in your mind, thrice to bend it to your will. My scalp tingles as my hair turns from blonde to black. My nose aches as it returns to its normal size, my forehead shrinking. I save my eyes for last. They burn like hot embers sizzling in my skull, but I force myself to keep them open while they revert back to their natural violet. I want to see the Duchess's face as she realizes it's me. I am not disappointed. Her mouth falls open. The dagger clatters to the floor, just out of Hazel's reach. She makes a grab for it, but the chain holds her back. The Duchess snatches the dagger away and grabs Hazel by the hair, yanking her upright and pressing the blade against her throat.
Stay back, she says.
Violet,
Hazel croaks.
You will not hurt her,
I hiss. I consider joining with Air and throwing the Duchess off the dais, but that could end in Hazel with her throat cut.
So,
the Duchess says, looking more comfortable now that she's got my sister's life to hold over me.
You have returned. I wondered if you would. That's part of the reason I took her in the first place. I thought perhaps you might get caught trying to save her.
She raises one eyebrow.
You disguised yourself well. I'll give you that.
Ash, Raven, and Garnet have formed a loose half-circle around me. Cora watches my every step eagerly, waiting for her own revenge.
And the rest of the reason?
I ask. The Duchess shrugs.
Well, I was hoping she'd have your abilities, of course. But it became evident rather quickly that she was not the surrogate you were. A child was not possible.
Something flickers in her eyes. Regret, maybe. But it vanishes before I can make sense of it. She pulls Hazel's head back farther.
When you escaped with the whore, I thought I was finished. I thought I would never get the thing I truly wanted. For my daughter to rule as I should have. But what is that quaint saying you have in the lower circles? When all you have left is lemons, make lemonade. I saw an opportunity. Why give a child the life that should have been mine? The Electress is so simple and stupid, so easy to manipulate. Why not use that to my advantage? After all, she did such a lovely job of shouting to anyone and everyone in the duel about how she hated me. How she did not wish a match with my house. She was jealous. Jealousy is a petty emotion. It pollutes the mind. It makes you rash. Because she had everything, and she did not appreciate it. Even worse, she did not deserve it in the first place.
So you stole my sister and went over the Electress's head to make a match with the Exeter?
Well deduced, the Duchess says with a sneer. And once Onyx realized there was a chance to be together again, well, we would do anything for each other. Even kill his bank trash wife. That is the depth of our love.
Where is he then? I ask, gesturing around. It looks like he's abandoned you.
Oh no, the Duchess says. He will never abandon me again.
Something in her tone makes me uncomfortable. Cora looks unnerved as well. She glances about the room, but it's empty except for the eight of us. But he did once, I say, trying to find a weak spot. My eyes flicker to the dagger still pressed to Hazel's neck. He left you. He married the Electress.
Don't speak as if you know anything about him,
the Duchess snaps. He never chose to leave me. We were forced apart. She raises her head proudly. We love each other, more than any two people have ever loved before. We made something beautiful together and they took it. They ripped it from me, even as I begged them not to. They called it a monster, the life that was growing inside me. There is a wild look in her eyes.
It's not fair, she cries. You poor, stupid, useless surrogates can bear a child, and I cannot.
I am stunned. The Duchess was pregnant. Royal women are sterilized upon marriage, but clearly the Duchess and Exeter slept together before that. I hear a gasp from Garnet. Even Cora seems shocked. It would have ruined the Duchess's house forever if the news got out. Her eyes are bright with tears, even as her hands shake with anger. A thick drop of blood oozes from the point of the blade and drips down Hazel's neck.
What a little fool I was,
the Duchess whispers.
To think they'd let me keep it.
For a moment, I can see her, the Duchess, young and in love. Who might she have grown into had things gone differently? I'm sorry that happened to you, I say. Carnelian tears her eyes away from Ash to give me a shocked look. It exactly mirrors the expression on the Duchess's face, and for the first time since I've known them, I can see that they are related. The Duchess's shock melts away to scorn.
I don't need your pity, she says, nor do I want it.
That's the difference between us, I say. You see pity, you see weakness, I see compassion, I see strength. But when you suffer, you feel you must make others suffer around you. You allowed this tragedy to turn you into something cold and cruel. You murdered Dahlia, a girl whose name you didn't even know, who had done nothing to you. You poisoned her out of spite. You killed Annabelle for no reason except to punish me. You took away a beautiful life on a whim to make a point. You might have become something great, Pearl, I say, taking a note from Raven's book and addressing the Duchess as an equal. And instead, you are just another petty, sniping royal.
She is infinitely more than that, a low voice says.
The Exeter steps out of the shadows as his guard files into the room, marching in unison, their red jackets matching the seats of the thrones.
Onyx,
the Duchess says with relief.
I was wondering where you were.
No less than 20 regimentals surround us, all carrying rifles. We are trapped. 27. The Exeter saunters over to kiss the Duchess on the cheek, ignoring Hazel struggling between them.
I was going to send these men out into the city, he says, but then I heard voices and I thought I should check on you.
I'm so glad you did, my darling. You remember my old surrogate, 197? She's come back to rescue her sister.
Just as you suspected, the Exeter says.
His gaze lands on Garnet.
What is he doing here?
He's with them, the Duchess says. Always such a disappointment. The Exeter traces the line of the Duchess's jaw with a finger.
You deserved better, he says.
They don't even look at us. Garnet's lone pistol is nothing against all those rifles. Neither is Ash's sword.
So, the Duchess says, turning to me, how long were you working with the eunuch?
My brain is spinning furiously, trying to come up with a solution to get us out of this. The best thing to do is to keep her talking while I figure out a plan.
He had a name, I say. I'm fully aware of Lucian's name. I simply don't...
He had a name, and it wasn't Lucian. Do you even understand why all of this is happening? I gesture out a window depicting a sunset in a blaze of colour. Can you even conceive of what you have done to the people of this city, to the island itself? The Duchess's smile is icy.
You are a foolish little girl. This island would be nothing without us.
We made it great. We created something where there was nothing before.
There wasn't nothing, I say. There were people here, and your ancestors, the ones you are so proud of, killed them all. Or at least they thought they did.
The Duchess stiffens, and the Exeter looks confused.
What is she talking about?
He asks. I have no idea, the Duchess replies. It's my turn to smile.
What did you think Lucian was doing in your library? Catching up on royal history?
You people, you haven't changed at all. Taking whatever you want.
Did you really think you killed all the paladin?
All the what?
Carnelian asks, but no one answers her.
How do you know about that?
The Duchess hisses. Because I am one of them, I say.
Who do you think brought that wall down?
You have no idea what I'm capable of.
Prove it, then.
The Duchess yanks Hazel's head back farther, so that she cries out in pain.
All I've seen from you thus far is a little bit of wind. Prove your strength. Kill me now, if you can.
I think about it. I think about the ceiling collapsing on her head, air snapping her neck, drowning her in the water I can sense in a garden just outside. But I am not the Duchess. I do not solve my problems the way she does, with violence and blood.
I could, I say carefully, but I won't.
The Duchess laughs, a high, echoing laugh.
I could, but I won't, she says, mimicking me.
Oh, that is rich.
The Exeter joins in. Cora is livid. She takes a step forward.
You promised you would kill her,
she cries. I'm sorry, I say. At the same time, the Duchess says,
I beg your pardon.
You murdered my daughter,
Cora cries, whirling around to face her mistress.
Did you think I wouldn't care? Did you honestly believe I felt nothing for her?
The Duchess levels Cora with one look. The lady-in-waiting withers.
I should have drowned that runt when she was born.
The Duchess says, you were lucky you got to know her at all.
Can you even hear yourself, Mother?
Garnet says.
Annabel was... She was the best person in that entire palace. She was wholly innocent. She was good.
No one is wholly innocent, the Duchess says.
If you believe that, you are even more stupid than I thought.
Her eyes flash to something behind me.
Let's start with the companion, shall we?
We have all been so focused on what's in front of us that none of us have looked back. I whirl around now, just as three of the Exeter's guard descend on Ash. Two grabbing his arms and throwing his sword aside, as another holds a gun to his temple.
No!
Carnelian and I scream together. The regimental holding the gun has a broad, ugly face, and a gold tooth that glints at me when he smiles. He has a brutish look, as if he enjoys hurting people. Ash keeps his eyes trained on mine and mouths one word. Hazel. I know what he means, but I can't. I can't make that choice. His eyes drink me in as if it's the last time, as if he'll never see me again.
Take me,
Carnelian offers.
Kill me instead. Please, just don't hurt him.
It is such a brave statement. I tear my gaze away from Ash to look at her face, stricken with fear but sincere. She would truly die for Ash. I can't believe I once thought her annoying, small-minded. I hated her for all the wrong reasons.
Carnelian, stop. You're embarrassing yourself.
The Duchess doesn't even spare her niece a glance. She looks gleeful at this turn of events. More blood drips down Hazel's neck.
What could anyone possibly gain from that? Alive or dead, you are nothing to me.
This companion risked his own life to be with a surrogate.
Do you see that? He does not love you.
Even your own mother preferred death to your company. What will it take for you to grasp the concept that no one wants you? Even I feel the sting of her words, how they cut right to Carnelian's core, a place that has been slashed by grief and cruelty 100 times over. Quick as lightning, I join with air. It's like it's been waiting for my call. The Duchess gives me one last disdainful glance.
Kill them all,
she says in a bored tone, but I am ready. And I will not let her hurt me or my friends. The rifles go off almost in unison, filling the room with sharp pops.
You can do this, Lucian whispers in my ear.
I believe in you. I feel every single bullet slicing through the air in this room, and I sweep them upward, circling them around the ceiling like a swarm of flies. Hazel slams her foot down on the Duchess's instep, causing the Duchess to let out a strangled howl and release her. The dagger falls off the dais. I raise my hands. The regimentals are all staring at the bullets in a daze of wonder and confusion. Slicing my hands through the air, I send the bullets flying back toward their owners, dropping the regimentals one by one. One I send through the chain binding my sister to the Duchess. It snaps in two. I sense, rather than see, the ugly regimental fire at me. I hear Ash cry out, and then there's a crunch behind me, and I send the bullet shooting away from me, not caring where it lands, as Hazel plummets into my arms. "You're safe now," I say, as she sobs against my shoulder. "I've got you. You're safe."
"No!"
The scream that issues from the Duchess's throat is wild, guttural, like the cry of a dying animal. And I see why. The last bullet I sent astray went right through the Exeter's chest. She gathers him up in her arms, tears streaming down her cheeks.
"Onyx, no, no, please."
Blood trickles from his mouth.
"Pearl,"
he says, reaching up to touch her cheek. Then his hand falls, limp and lifeless, and his head rolls to one side. The Duchess falls over him, clutching his body. Then her head whips up.
"I will kill you slowly for this," she says.
She lays the Exeter gently on the floor and rises to face me. I push Hazel behind my back and prepare to join with Earth, to open up the ground beneath her feet.
"Do you understand me? I will k—"
Then she gasps, her back arching. A horrible choking sound comes out of her throat. Red begins to seep through her blue dress, staining it, changing its colour like an augury. Carnelian stands behind her. In one swift movement, she pulls the dagger out of the Duchess's back and holds it up triumphantly. She must have picked it up when the Duchess dropped it.
"You are such a disappointment, Carnelian,"
Carnelian hisses in a mockery of the Duchess's voice, stabbing the dagger into her back again.
"No one cares what you have to say, Carnelian."
The dagger hits its mark for a third time.
"No one loves you. No one loves you."
She stabs the Duchess again and again, and I can only watch, stunned and horrified. The Duchess falls to the floor beside the Exeter. Carnelian looks like she's about to keep stabbing her, when Ash rushes over. He holds her wrist gently. Carnelian is shaking.
"It's all right," he murmurs. "You can let it go now. She's gone. It's all right."
She blinks and looks at him.
She was so... I had to."
"I know," he says. The dagger clatters to the floor. She falls into him, sobbing, and he holds her tight. Our eyes meet over the crown of her head. The scene does not make me jealous as it once would. Hazel is gripping my arm, and I turn to face her. "Let's get this stuff off you," I say. Raven helps me with the leash, and I rip the veil off her face. Garnet has gone over to help Cora. Hazel steps out of her high heels so she is her normal height again, and together we unstrap the fake belly from over her stomach. She kicks it away viciously.
"Is it over?"
she asks. "It's over," I say. She collapses into me, and we hold each other tight.
"All those things you did,"
she says, pulling away to look up at me.
"With the wind and the bullets and..."
She gazes around the room, dazed.
"You told me you could do things, but..."
"You can do those things too," I say. Hazel blinks.
"I can?"
I smile. "This is Raven," I say. "She's my best friend. She can show you if you want."
"You want me to take her to the cliff now?" Raven asks.
"What?"
Hazel asks. "Maybe not right this second," I say. "Maybe it's too soon. Hazel needs to rest. She..."
"I've been doing nothing but rest for months,"
Hazel says, stepping back and crossing her arms over her chest.
"Show me whatever it is. I can handle it."
My chest swells with pride. "I know you can," I say. "Come on." We leave the throne room and exit out into a garden filled with butterflies and rose bushes. The sun is molten gold in a perfect blue sky. I feel an overwhelming sense of exuberance. We did it. Raven grips my hand as I take Hazel's.
What are we doing?
She asks. We're going to show you who you really are, I say. I've said it so many times before, at Southgate, Westgate, at all the holding facilities. I've given girls something to believe in, showed them what they were capable of. But it's never meant as much to me as it does now. The cliff is perfect when we arrive. The sky mirrors our sky, cloudless and bright blue. The air is warm, and bees buzz lazily around the monument. The trees are lush and green, and the gentle roar of the ocean is soothing below. How I long to see the true ocean. I turn to my sister. She stares around, captivated by the beauty and wonder of this place. Her violet eyes are filled with awe. I sigh.
Change her back,
I whisper silently to this space, to my ancestors who linger just beyond, in a place between living and dead.
Please.
Change her back, Raven whispers beside me. Our pleas drift into the air and swirl around the silvery blue monument, and it's as if I can hear 100 voices taking up the cry. Change her back. Change her back. Hazel has run to the edge of the cliff, gazing out across the ocean. Suddenly, she grabs her face, dropping to her knees. I start to run toward her, but Raven stops me, keeping a tight grip on my hand. Hazel rocks back and forth for a few moments, then goes still. When she turns back to me, my heart leaps to my throat, and if I could make a sound, cry out in this place, I would. The magic of this cliff has worked. The paladin have returned her to who she once was. Whatever the doctor did was no match for the power that exists here. Hazel's face is the one I remember, the one I grew up with. Her eyes are back to their original colour, her nose and mouth and cheeks all the same as they used to be. She stares the same wide-eyed stare I've seen on the faces of so many girls now. Raven and I join her at the edge of the cliff. We look out at the ocean, letting the salty tang fill our nostrils, and I feel a sense of wonder, of curiosity. I feel as if I'm a very small part of something so large. It cannot be contained in one island, one city. I wonder what is out there.
Me too, Raven thinks. Want to find out?
Yes, I think back. But there is something I have to do first.
28. When we return from the cliff, we find that Hazel's flowers are white, like mine were. She bends down and they grow taller, reaching toward her fingertips, their cheery faces brushing her skin before withering to die, even as new ones grow to take their place. What do you feel? I ask, wondering which elements she can connect with.
Everything,
she whispers.
I can feel the grass growing and hear the wind whispering, and there's something shimmery and flowy. Like water.
I clasp her shoulders in my hands. Stay out here for a little while. Everything is going to be different from now on. Enjoy this moment. It's the beginning of your new life. In so many ways, I think. It's a new city. It's a new world. I don't want to leave my sister, but there's something I have to do, or more accurately, a place I need to visit. I turn to Raven, but she's a step ahead of me. The benefit of having a best friend who can sometimes read your thoughts.
Garnet and I will stay here, she says. Go.
I wonder if she knows where I'm going, or just that I need to go. Either way, I smile and embrace her, squeezing her tight.
We did it,
I whisper.
We did,
she whispers back. Hazel has sunk down to the grass and is staring at a rose bush with a look of wonder on her face. A bud blossoms suddenly, a swirl of colour unfolding as its petals grow. I leave her to the awe of nature and head inside. Garnet and Cora have moved the Duchess's and Executor's bodies aside and are stacking the rifles up in a pile in the centre of the room. Carnelian sits on the edge of the dais, beside Ash, still looking shell-shocked. Ash stands as I enter. I sway a little on my feet, suddenly overwhelmingly tired. But this day isn't over yet. Hazel, he says, coming over to grip my elbow. She's fine. I keep my eyes on his, not wanting to look at the bodies on the floor. I have to go someplace, in this palace,
a secret place. I have to... I don't know what I have to do. All I know is that I want to go back to Lucian's workshop. I don't need to destroy it anymore, now that the society has won. But I want to see that there is still some piece of him left in this world. Ash's arm snakes around my waist as his lips press against my temple. "Wherever you need to go," he says, "I'll be with you." We leave the throne room and walk back down the empty halls to the front doors, hand in hand. I take a right and am about to lead him to the antechamber when I stop. "I want you to see," I say to him, the guilt surging up in a hot wave inside my chest. "I want you to see the awful thing I did." I open the door to the room of mirrors. Ash gasps and steps inside, his face alight with astonishment, fractured in the broken mirrors. Some have been removed so there are blank spaces, as if servants stopped cleaning up halfway through. But there are still plenty of keys lining these walls. "You did this?" he asks. "The night before the auction. There was a royal dinner and I came with Carnelian. I was mad, frustrated, ready for this to be over. I didn't think anyone would see it. There are hundreds of rooms in this palace. I thought I was being so clever." My throat swells up and I stop talking. "I wasn't being clever. I was being foolish, and Lucian lost his life because of it." Ash looks at me as though he can read my thoughts, my guilt printed clearly on my face. "So what should your punishment be?" "I don't know," I murmur. I stare at myself in an oval mirror. One of my eyes is fractured, my mouth a diagonal slash. Ash tucks a stray lock of hair behind my ear and cups my face in his hands. "Do you really think Lucian would want you punished for this? Don't you think he'd be proud? You made his mark on the place where he was enslaved for most of his life."
"I killed him," I croak.
"No," Ash says firmly. "The royalty killed him." I can see he knows I don't believe him. "You made a choice, Violet, one that had consequences, like saving me, like saving Raven. Not all choices result in what we want, or even what we expect. But what you've done, what Lucian has done, what me and Raven and Garnet and everyone at the White Rose and everyone in the society has been trying to do, is give everybody, no matter their station or their status, a chance at making choices for themselves. Some things are bigger than just one person." He enfolds me in his arms and whispers into my ear. "But that doesn't mean it doesn't hurt. To lose him, to feel pain, and that's okay. Just don't hate yourself for it." A fat tear drips down my cheek and bleeds into the fabric of his shirt.
"Come with me,"
I whisper. I open the picture of the dog in the antechamber and climb through the hole to the staircase. Ash doesn't ask any questions. He just follows after me, and we climb the stairs. Lucian has left markings, as he said, white X's that tell me where to turn and which halls to take. After what feels like an hour, we are standing outside the door to his room. I open it with trembling hands. Lucian's bedroom is a mess. This must have been where he was when he was arrested. Blankets and clothes are scattered about, and the dresser has been knocked over. But the closet is untouched, hiding the workshop behind it. It's only a few feet away, but it may as well be a mile. It may as well be on another planet. My legs have turned to stone and melted into the floor. I can't move. I can barely breathe. Ash has no idea what this place is, what it could mean, and yet he threads his fingers through mine, not hesitating to stand by my side. And in that moment, I know that while I may have lost Lucian, the effects he has had on me, on my life, on my friends and the people I love, will last forever. Keeping Ash's hand firmly in my grasp, I take a step forward, then another. Then I'm walking, no, almost running to the closet. I throw the doors open, push aside the lady-in-waiting gowns, and pull the arcana out of my hair. I press it into the indentation in the door's centre. It opens with a click. I stand on the threshold, my skin tingling. The lights flicker on inside. "Violet?" Ash asks. "Wait here," I say. "Please." I open the door wide and leave Ash behind, knowing he'll listen to me, knowing that even if he doesn't understand why, he trusts that I'm asking him for what I need. I step into Lucian's workroom and the memory hits me like a blow to the stomach. The clocks on the wall tick casually.
unaware that their owner is never returning. The books, the papers, the beakers, all of it is as it was that day Lucian showed this place to me, back when I was Imogen, and Coral was still alive. My gaze lands on the easel in the corner, and I let out a tiny cry, somewhere between a gasp and a sob. The picture Lucian was painting, the one that was just the outline of a girl, the one I thought was of Azalea. It's me. Lucian has drawn my face in perfect detail, right down to the little point of my chin. I'm looking slightly to the left, smiling in a way that is at once sweet and mischievous, like perhaps I'm about to do something reckless. My hair tumbles over my shoulders, and my eyes, he got their colour just right. I see tubes of various shades of purple scattered across his work table. I gaze at it, guilt and grief and love warring inside me. The tears are falling thick and fast, and I don't bother to wipe them away. My head spins and my legs weaken, so that the room swirls in my vision, and I know I'm about to collapse. A pair of strong arms grabs me, pulling me upright. Ash's familiar scent is like its own embrace, but it only makes me cry harder. The weight of this whole day crushes me, and I sob until there is nothing left to cry. Ash doesn't say a word. He just lets me get it out. Finally, I straighten up, gulping for air. I smile at him blearily, and he wipes the tears from my cheeks. This place is incredible, he says, and so very him. I swallow hard. My hands snake down his arms, gripping his wrists. I look around the room one more time. He told me to destroy it if we lost. He made me promise. Well, Ash says, I'm glad that's one promise you don't have to keep. The exhaustion hits me again, and suddenly all I want is to be with my sister. Let's go, I say. But as we turn to leave, my eye lands on something shiny. The copper spring that Lucian was toying with when he talked to me about his wall of clocks. The one he unwound and tossed aside on the table. I pick it up and slip it into my pocket. Then I take my arcana out of the door, and Ash and I walk back to join our friends and my family. 29. We bury our dead the next day. The Royal Palace has become the new headquarters for the Society of the Black Key. People started filtering in yesterday at sunset. Servants, society members, friendly regimentals, Paladin. Syl came with her group after making neat work of that damned wall, as she put it. Sienna followed later, and I was so relieved to see her. I hugged her tight, and she actually hugged me back. Oka arrives in the morning with a group of boys around his age, and Hazel and I tackle him, falling to the ground in a mess of hugs and laughter and tears.
Why didn't you tell me about the society?
Hazel asks, punching him in the arm.
I did, Oka protests, holding up his hands to block her. You didn't believe me.
Wait till you see what I can do, Hazel brags.
Is it like what Violet can do with water and stuff?
When did you see that?
I've been part of the society for ages, Hazel, he says importantly. Stop it, you two, I say with a wide grin, wrapping my arms around both their shoulders. I'm just happy we're all together again.
There is a meeting that night about what to do with the remaining royals. Many, as Lucian had said, want executions across the board. Others, like Syl, insist the royals should pay with hard labour. Finally, an agreement is reached. A tribunal will be set up, with representatives from each circle present, and the royalty will be judged for their crimes. I sit apart from the main crowd, with Ash, Raven, Garnet, Ochre, and Hazel, an idea chewing at the edges of my mind. I get up and motion to Syl to follow me. She does, without question, and I take her to Lucian's workshop.
Well,
she says after several long moments of silence. She shakes her head.
If anyone were to have a place like this, it would be him.
I think maybe there are things here that could help the society, or the new government, whatever it will be called. I run my fingers across the prototype of Annabelle's slate. When I glance up, Syl is looking at me strangely.
You know, she says, walking over to the bookshelves and peering at the various titles. I've known Lucian for almost 5 years. The first day I met him, I blew him off my porch with air.
You did, I say.
What would you do if a lady-in-waiting showed up at your front door, in a place you thought no one could find? Syl says, but our mocking is gentle. He didn't like me much after that. Of course, we had to get along, for Azalea's sake.
I know, I say.
But Azalea never brought us together the way you did, Syl says.
I stare at her, dumbstruck, but she's refusing to look at me, flipping through an old leather-bound tome.
I saw a change in Lucian, even before I met you myself. The way he used to talk about you. If I heard one more damn Violet story, whether he was proud or worried or just bothering me with an arcana to complain about you.
She chuckles at the book. I'm having difficulty breathing.
He'd lived in that circle for so long. I don't think he realized how much it had affected him, even if he never wanted it to. But you did. You held up a mirror and reminded him that he was just as worthy of saving as the surrogates.
Of course he was, I whisper.
You say that like it's an easy thing to believe, she says with a snort. And then he showed up at my door again with not one but two surrogates, a companion and a royal.
Syl lets out an exasperated sigh.
I was so mad. Well, you know, you were there. That wasn't the plan. Saving those people, a pregnant surrogate, a companion, it was such a risk. Lucian and I, we were so wrapped up in what we were supposed to be doing, we forgot why we were doing it. I thought it was just revenge. That's all I wanted at first, and I think he did too. Revenge for Azalea, blood for blood.
She finally meets my gaze. Her eyes are red and glassy.
We were wrong. You showed us what really mattered. You changed us both. I wish I could make you see that, Violet.
She turns away, wiping her nose with her sleeve.
He was a fool, to be sure. But you can't say he didn't love you.
I sink into the armchair. Syl quickly busies herself with examining papers and looking at beakers and saying things that don't make sense to me, like,
the apothecary will be very interested in this. Or, got to make sure the foreigner gets a look at these.
Lucian is gone. The revolution is over. It's time for me to exercise the freedom we fought so hard for. Syl, I say hesitantly.
Mm?
She replies, not looking up from a beaker filled with simmering blue liquid. I want to leave. There's something I want to do. I know there's so much work to do here and things to figure out, but... She gives me her most penetrating stare.
Spit it out,
she says. I want to see the ocean. It's been tugging at my heart, the desire to see over the Great Wall. To see what's out there. To get to the edge of this little piece of my world and climb the wall the royalty built. To see what hasn't been seen in centuries. Syl's pale eyes soften with understanding.
You do what you have to,
she says, patting me on the shoulder, before turning back to Lucian's table. We bury the fallen in the lawn surrounding the auction house, the paladin burying our own separately, under a little copse of trees. 25 in all. Indy, Olive, little Rosie Kelting. Ginger died too. As we cover them with earth, a myriad of flowers grow up over their graves, each girl's flowers sprouting from the earth one last time. I see Indy's lemon-yellow blossoms entwine with Olive's dark green ones. I want to see the ocean, I say to Raven. She grins at me.
So do I. We're all coming with you.
We? I ask, startled. She glances over to where Ash and Garnet stand, a little apart, watching this private funeral from a respectable distance. Raven sighs dramatically.
If we left without them, they'd just follow after us anyway.
She throws an arm around my shoulder.
When do you want to leave?
It's another day before we are ready to set out. I expect Hazel and Ochre to come, to be eager to go home to the marsh. But to my surprise, they both staunchly refuse. I can't go back, Hazel says. Everything is different now. I mean something. I matter here. I can't go back to the marsh like everything is the same because it's not. I'm not.
Yeah, Ochre agrees. Besides, the society needs me.
Stubborn, Lucian's voice whispers. Just like me, I think. All right, I say. I won't argue with them. They need to make their own choices now.
Be safe, Sienna says. Don't do anything stupid.
Syl adds, it's still dangerous out there. There's fighting in the lower circles. I wouldn't worry about us, Syl, Garnet says cheerfully, clapping her on the back. Don't you know we've got the most powerful paladin in recent history as our guide?
Second most powerful,
Syl grumbles, and we all laugh. We leave through the ruined south part of the wall, the one by the auction house. It takes us the better part of the day to make it across the bank, which has surrendered rather quickly to the fall of the royalty, though there's a hefty amount of destruction all around us. Many stores have been looted or burned. When we reach the wall, Garnet glances at me.
Can you get us through? He asks.
Of course she can, Ash says, and I grin. I join with Earth and welcome the thick, mighty sense of being rooted in something deep and ancient. I feel the stones of these walls, greeting them like old friends. And when they begin to break apart, I fill up with a blissful power. This one isn't nearly as thick as the wall that surrounded the jewel. I make only a narrow fissure, just wide enough for us to climb through. The scene that meets our eyes is one of widespread devastation. Maybe because there were more things to explode in the smoke. Factories have been levelled, there are bodies in the streets, and constant outbreaks of fighting. I'm grateful when we reach the wall to the farm. At first, this circle seems untouched by the violence, until we come across the first burned-out farmhouse, the fields surrounding it dead and blackened. It takes several days to cross the farm. We reach the wall to the marsh late at night. My feet are sore, and my back aches. But when I draw on Earth, my strength returns. The wall is black against the night sky, but I don't need to see it to break it. It is too dark to continue into the marsh, so we camp in the shadow of the wall. I wake at dawn. The air is chilly, drops of dew forming on my hair like crystals. I stare at the pearlescent strip of grey in the distance that grows lighter. Then a streak of orange appears, underscored with slashes of pink and gold. Slowly, a symphony of colour plays out in the sky, nature welcoming the beginning of a new day. I have always loved sunrises. There is something hopeful about them. After a quick breakfast, we set off again. Raven and I agree to visit our families on our way back. I fear if I see my mother now, I may never leave her. At first, the marsh appears to be deserted, but then I realise that most of the labourers must have been in the other circles. We see the elderly, and children with young mothers, or children with no mothers at all. The great wall looms in the distance, but it never seems to come any closer. Until suddenly, the mud brick houses end, and we stand at the edge of a vast expanse of dry, cracked earth. The wall rises up before us. It is larger than I imagined, larger by far than any of the other walls in this city, and I know I would never be able to take it down on my own. It grows more massive the closer we get to it. The wind blows sharply across the empty plain, whipping specks of dirt and dust up around us. We walk and walk, and the wall looms higher and higher. By the time we reach it, it hurts my neck to look up to the top. I turn to my companions. I can't break this one down. Garnet's eyes are wide. Ash looks slightly stunned. It's so big, Raven finishes. Big doesn't seem like enough. The stones are grey and murky brown. Some are covered with lichens or moss. She reaches out and runs her hand over its rough surface, then gasps. Follow me, she says, taking off at a jog. Garnet rushes to catch up to her, and Ash and I take up the rear. Whatever Raven's looking for, she doesn't find it for nearly half an hour. There! She cries triumphantly, pointing at what appears to be just more wall. But then I see the contrast, the shadows, the place where steps have been carved into the stony surface. Up, up, up they go, to a dizzying height that sets my head spinning. But I have to see it. At first, the stairs are wide and smooth, but the higher we go, the narrower they become. By the time we are halfway up, my thighs are in agony, and there's a painful stitch in my side. The drop below me is terrifying, worse than in the sewers when we had to climb that rusty ladder to get into the bank, worse than the top of the golden spire in the auction house, where Sienna and I sent up the flare. Three quarters of the way up, and everything below us has turned miniature. Minuscule houses, baby trees. I can see straight across the marsh to the wall of the farm.
How long do you think it took to build this?
Ash pants.
25 years,
Garnet says. Raven gives him a surprised look.
What? He says. You think I could have lived with my mother all my life and not known that? She loves to...
He stops himself and clears his throat.
She loved to say how our family built it, funded it, yes, but I'll be damned if a single member of the House of the Lake ever touched a brick or stone.
They are now, Raven points out. Garnet looks at his own hands like he's never seen them before.
Yeah, he says. I guess you're right. Then he shrugs. Well, there isn't a House of the Lake anymore, so I'm no one, really.
Don't ever let me hear you say that again, Raven snaps. After all you've given up, after everything you've done.
Can we keep moving, please? Ash says. He stands with his back pressed against the stone, his skin taking on a greyish tinge.
You didn't have to come, I say as we plod forward. Each step makes the muscles in my legs burn.
Yes, I did, he says through gritted teeth. I want to see what's out there, same as you.
I didn't know you were so afraid of heights.
He lets out a breathy laugh. I didn't either. This isn't just high up. I feel like, I don't know, like we're walking straight into the sky.
When we reach the top, it truly does feel as if we've emerged into some other world. The top of the wall is easily 20 feet wide, the stone pockmarked. The wind is vicious up here, but something about it pricks at me, like little fingers pinching and nibbling as if to get a sense of who I am. I walk to the other side, shaking with trepidation. The lip of the wall comes into view, and then there it is. The ocean. Exactly as we saw it on the cliff. I hear a gasp, and Raven's hand slips into mine. It is grey and blue and endless. White-capped waves crash onto a long strip of beach, hundreds of feet below. The wall stretches away in every direction, and for a moment, I could easily believe there is nothing else out there, that this island is the only thing in the world besides water. Then I see the ships. Their hulls are rotting, their masts splintered, the sails eaten by wind and water and time. But they are there, maybe a dozen of them, gathered together in a cove near the wall. Perhaps the royalty kept them there for sentimental reasons, or they have simply been forgotten, lost to time. The only thing that matters is they are here, which means the royalty came from another land, as Syl's book said.
I've only ever seen ships like those in pictures, Garnet says in awe.
Ash has collapsed on the ground, staring out at the ocean with greedy eyes, as if he can't see enough of it. I sit beside him.
I never thought I'd see it, he says.
Me neither.
But you have seen it.
Not like this.
It's incredible,
Raven says, wrapping an arm around Garnet's waist as he kisses her temple. The briny tang fills my nose, sharp and sweet all at once. The crash of the waves mixes with the wailing of the wind, and in it I hear something else too, something that might be singing, in a strange language that I don't understand. It lifts my heart and makes me sad at the same time. We are taking this island back, I think, wondering if these ghosts of the Paladin can hear me, can understand my thoughts. For you. For us. The singing swells up around me before fading into the wind, the dying echo of a race that was nearly extinguished, but survived. We sit on the Great Wall and watch the sun sink lower toward the horizon. Ash's hand is warm around mine. I feel complete here. The rebellion, the royalty, the city itself all seem so far away. There is only the rich blue of the sky, the gentle bite of the wind, and the dim roar of the ocean. I look at my friends and think about who we all once were and how far we have come. I am Violet Lasting again. I am home.